Well, I'm just going to go on the...
You might want to do a panel of 3 and 3.
Oh.
I think it'd be fine.
Yeah, well... Okay, where is
this?
You want these two to go over the grand?
Your mics are on.
Okay.
I think everybody's fine with it. I don't know. Just as if I leave the receiver.
Interim Committee on Public Health Order. Mr. Administrator. I'm Senator Bill Morissette. I chair the committee. We did deal with the bill last session. We're very interested in hearing kind of the overview, and we're interested in hearing what the concerns are with medical marijuana. That's what we're going to be dealing with first. So welcome to everyone. Senator Cruz is walking in just in time to introduce himself. Senator Cruz, would you tell us why you're here?
Senator, you told me to be here. Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is most of Douglas County, the part of Coos County that Senator Berger doesn't have, all of Curry County, parts of Jackson and Josephine, and I have been in the legislature since 97, so
and
happy to be here, Senator.
Thank you. Senator Cruz and I co-sponsored the bill that we're going to be talking about this morning. Senator Berger?
Yes, my name is Joanne Berger, and I represent District 5. I say it's the most beautiful Senate district in the United States. It starts at Coos Bay and goes to Lincoln City, and I look forward to the drive every time I have to go to a meeting, and that can't be said for everybody.
That's true.
I've been in the legislature since, I served two sessions in the House, and last session in the Senate, and I will be back for the finish of a four-year term.
Okay, thank you. Senator Gordley.
Good morning. My name is Avel Gordley, and I represent Senate District 23, which includes wonderful neighborhoods in northeast and southeast Portland. And what we like to say in my district is that we are the district where diversity really works. I've been a member of the Oregon Legislative Assembly since 1991. And every day is an education. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experience and privilege to serve.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to start this morning with kind of an overview of the administrative rules. Dr. Grant Higginson, would you come up, please? And you can sit in the middle. And Rick Bayer and Madeline Martinez, if you would come up. We're on kind of a tight schedule, so we're going to ask, we're going to have about 15 minutes. About 45 minutes for this, if we can get through it. And I'm sure we can. Thank you.
Great. Good morning. Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I am one of those people who actually does not look forward to the drive every time I have to come to Salem from Portland. But what I'm here to talk about today is the DHS, Department of Human Services, rulemaking around Senate Bill 1085, which, as you know, is the bill that you chair and Senator Cruz co-sponsored last session. This, from my perspective, was the most significant changes to, provided the most significant changes to the medical marijuana program since the ballot measure was passed in 1998. What I've done in the little handout that I provided to you is gone through what we picked out as the number of issues that we saw that were changes to the existing Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. And what Senate Bill 1085 did was change the definition of mature plants versus seedlings or starts. It increased the amount of marijuana that was allowable for a person to possess to 6 mature plants and up to 24 ounces of usable marijuana, and also 18 starts or seedlings. That increase was offset by an elimination of the affirmative defense for excessive amounts, so that in the past, whereas if a physician had said a person needed more marijuana, that provided an affirmative defense, and that was taken out of the statute. It also clarified the patient's ownership of plants, so that it's clear that even if the plants are not being grown on the resident of the patient still is the one who owns them. It allows for some compensation for some of the growing costs associated with growing medical marijuana. However, it still is precluded for selling medical marijuana in any event. It also allows licensed healthcare professionals to administer medical marijuana to a registered cardholder who was living in a licensed healthcare facility. However, it does not require either the licensed healthcare professional or a healthcare facility to engage in those practices. And also, it requires a card to be on a person if they are transporting medical marijuana. It also mandates the creation of a registry where we have the grow site locations for everyone who is in the program, and therefore it created this new category of a grower. It, however, puts some restrictions on who a grower can be, and also limits growers to being able to grow medical marijuana for up to 4 patients or caregivers per year. It also mandated a 24/7 law enforcement verification system and required the formation of an advisory committee, which we had informally in the past, but not formally in statute. And so at this point, that's what we saw as the key changes from Senate Bill 1085. And at this point, I did want to remind members of the committee that while this applied to the entire act, that the Department of Human Services Oregon Medical Marijuana Program is actually very limited in what our responsibility is. Our responsibility is to administer a registration system for the act, and consequently the only issues that we dealt with in rulemaking were those last 3 bullets. And so the first thing that we did, and all of these things we did January 1, 2006, is we created a registry for growers and grow site locations. So we added to our database a category for growers and required that everyone have a grow site listed. We also set the limit of 4 patients per caregiver at any time, so if we get more than that into the data system, we will not allow that. However, here I have to qualify it that there was potentially some difference between legislative intent and what actually came out in the rules. The way that the rules were the way that the statute was constructed, it talks about what happens when the grow site is not at the site, the residence of a patient or a caregiver. In those cases, when there is a grower growing, it can only be for 4 patients. For a patient who is growing, they can grow for 4 people plus themselves for 5 people. But again, the way that the law is written, we believe that it states that if you are a caregiver, you can have unlimited people who you are caring for, and therefore unlimited people that you can grow for. So right now, a grower is limited to 4, a patient is limited to 5, and a care grower is not restricted on how many patients or caregivers they can grow for.
Chair, we spent a lot of time on this issue in our work groups, and clearly I thought, knowing full well that if you have 2 lawyers looking over a document, they can come up with 5 opinions And I've seen that happen with legislation I've done before, but I guess, Grant, my issue with that is, language being what it was, if there's uncertainty in language, legislative intent clearly comes into play there, and I know that during the process and during the committee hearings and on the floor, we spoke to that intent, and I think that has been voiced by members of the Senate since then what the intent was, and this rule seems to be going diametrically opposed to what our intent was.
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, when we started working on the rules, your recollection of intent was what I had remembered from the hearings as well, and consequently we talked to you and Senator Morissette, Senator Prithansky, other people who had been involved, law enforcement as well. If you read the statute, though, it says if marijuana used by the registered identification cardholder is produced at a marijuana grow site where the cardholder or designated primary caregiver is not present. And then it goes on to list these things, and one of the things it lists is that may produce for up to 4 registry identification cardholders. And so the interpretation by our legal counsel said that because it says when it's not grown at that site, this applies. When it is grown at that site, it does not apply. And our counsel talked with other counsel in the Department of Justice and also with one of the county councils as well, and we did not see how we could differ from what we put in our rules.
Did you consult with the legislative counsel who drafted the measure?
Chair Morissette, yes, we did, and we also reviewed tapes to see if there was anything that we could find either in written testimony or in verbal testimony that we could definitely say that there was legislative intent, and again, our counsel felt that there was not.
Okay. Now, the caregiver growing for more than 4 patients would have to grow on the site of the patient. Is that correct?
Chair Morissette, no. If a caregiver is growing at their site, their personal site, okay, our interpretation of the law was that they can grow for as many patients.
So we have as many patients
as they are a caregiver for.
Okay, I remember the discussion dealing with the difference between the caregiver and the grower. I remember that discussion, but I don't think there was an intent to create a third category, because the caregiver used to be the grower. Those terms were interchangeable at one time, because we said the caregiver is the person who takes care of the patient and could be the grower, but the way the rule is written, then we have the grower, the caregiver who grows at their site, and the patient, and I don't, that is not what we envision.
Mr. Chair, one more point. I mean, as part of the balance we're trying to get was we increased the amount that could be in possession, and we limited the number of grows. And admittedly, that's one of the reasons we meet rather frequently to fix our own mistakes, and clearly this was one, but this kind of goes against the balance we were trying to create, Mr. Chair, in this thing. So clearly, I think we all knew we'd be revisiting the issue. So we need to make note that this is a key issue that needs to be dealt with.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Grant, we also stipulate in the bill the number of plants and the fact that a growth site card has to be present. That still applies for someone, for a caregiver growing off-site, that their growth site card has to be present for each person they're growing for, and there has to be X number of plants. So there's a formula, I guess, to kind of measure how many people might be growing for at any one site.
Yeah, Chair Morissette and Mr. Bacobian, that is correct. It's still a... For every patient a grower is growing for, they have to have that grow site card on the site at the grow site. Okay, and then another thing is that there was a restriction on who could be a grower, that it could not be a person who had been convicted of certain crimes within the last 5 years. And so another thing we implemented was a criminal background check to ensure that we were only giving grow site registration cards to those people who were qualified. And also because this took effect on January 1, it did affect all the over 10,000 patients in the system, and so we notified them of the changes and their requirement to now give us a person responsible for a grow site name. The second thing that we worked on was the 24/7 law enforcement verification system, and so we have now set up this link between the LED system, the law enforcement data system, and our program, so that there can be checking of information 24 hours a day. For confidentiality purposes, there have been these strict firewalls that have been set up, and when law enforcement does call in, they can only verify. They get a yes-no answer to a name that's submitted or an address that is submitted. Law enforcement can still call us during regular business hours, and the confidentiality requirements that are specified in the law for us also are the same for law enforcement. And then the final thing we've done is to help set up the advisory committee that was required by law. Director of Department of Human Services, Bruce Goldberg, appointed 11 members early in 2006. The committee met in March and, again, is going to meet tomorrow. Okay. And that's the end of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay. Thank you. Why don't you just stay there if you don't
mind. I will stay there.
Yeah, okay. Dr. Baker.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for receiving my testimony. For the record, my name is Richard Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, M-D. I'm board certified in internal medicine and practiced in Oregon from 1981 to 1996, routinely caring for patients with chronic illnesses. After a blood clot ended my practice, I stayed active in medicine, was awarded a fellowship in the American College of Physicians, and co-authored the book, Is Marijuana the Right Medicine for You? A Factual Guide to the Medical Uses of Marijuana. I was a chief petitioner, co-author, and spokesperson for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act that Oregon voters approved in November 1998. I maintain a website with a medical cannabis bibliography, authored an article in the peer-reviewed Journal of Cannabis Therapeutics, regularly reviewed medical literature concerning cannabis, and have testified routinely as an expert in Oregon courts. A possibly overlooked part of Senate Bill 1085 that I wanted to discuss today is the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana. ORS 475.303 sub 3 states, quote, "The committee shall advise the DHS director on the administrative aspects of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, review current administrative rules of the program, and provide annual input on the fee structure of the program." And that's also the mission statement of the advisory committee. Currently, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program annual permit fee is $100 for most people, but for the approximately 30% of our population that's on Oregon Health Plan or receives SSI, they receive a discount down to $20, not $100, but $20, and many people can't afford this. Unfortunately, the Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services has published the Domino Effect, a business plan for rebuilding substance abuse prevention, treatment, and recovery. It's prepared for Governor Kulongoski and members of the Oregon Legislative Assembly by the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. The cover page says to contact the Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services for additional information or copies of the report, so they are the spokespersons and the sponsors. This Governor's Council recommendation proposes to, quote, increase medical marijuana card application and renewal fee to $150 and earmark revenue above the level required to administer the program for prevention, treatment, and recovery services beginning in the 2007-2009 biennium. Now, the Domino Effect provides no evidence that medical marijuana supervised by physicians raises any cost to Oregonians. In fact, there's lots of anecdotal evidence that medical marijuana decreases costs to Oregonians because many patients, including those on the Oregon Health Plan, choose the herbal cannabis because of cost effectiveness or adverse effects related to the expensive pharmaceuticals. In spite of this, the domino effect proposes a medicine tax. This is a tax, folks, and it's egregiously targeting Oregonians with pain syndromes, cancer, HIV, multiple sclerosis, and other debilitating conditions. And while this medicine tax also ignores the 30% of Oregon medical marijuana patients who are in dire poverty and cannot afford the application fees to go from $20 to $150, not to mention going from $100 to $150. Now, everybody up there who knows the Oregon Medical Marijuana Plan knows that when they can't afford this tax, they're not going to register with the program. That's a fact. Actions that discourage registration with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program undermine Senate Bill 1085. I'm going to repeat that. Actions that discourage registration with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program undermine this Senate bill. This medicine tax cost shifts onto Oregon's chronically ill. And then after the poor and sick can no longer afford the squeeze, there's going to be an increase in the number of unregistered medical marijuana grow sites by 30 to 50%. And that's conservative. Bipartisan efforts to pass Senate Bill 1085 included legislators and law enforcement who sought less unregistered medical marijuana grow sites. But the domino effect is going to give us more unregistered marijuana grow sites. In summary, the domino effect levies a discriminatory tax. It's a tax on the sickest and the poorest Oregonians. It decreases access to health care. And it wastes taxpayers' money. The domino effect section targeting medical marijuana patients should be opposed by anybody who supports Senate Bill 1085. Thank you. And that's what I wanted to make my comment about as the advisory committee chair. Thank you. And I'd be very happy to answer questions, including the questions that I got from Senator Verger.
Thank you.
But did you have questions on this before we went to...
The questions that you have came from some constituents of mine that would like to have you address those questions, if you would like.
May I address them now?
You certainly may.
Okay. What I have in front of me is a piece of paper that has questions on it, and under the part for Dr. Bayer, ACMM, which is about two-thirds of the way down the page, it says, what do you think are the greatest barriers facing Oregon patients wanting to use medical marijuana? Well, I'm a doctor, and we're talking about health care. I think the greatest barrier is always cost. And after the cost, it's access to medicine. Because what I'm getting back from patients is I can't afford the permit fee. I can't afford to see the doctor for this. But that's the same thing we're all hearing about a lot of medicine, not just medical marijuana. So I think that the same parallels that we see with our health crisis as far as patients being able to access their regular medicines, whether it's their hypertension medicines or whatever, is the same sort of thing, Senator Verger, that we're seeing with the medical marijuana. Cost issues are more than 90% of the problems. If the patients had the money, they could afford to see the doctors, they could afford to pay the fees, they wouldn't care that the fees are going up to $150 if the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services gets their way, because they'd have lots of money. But the cost is the issue. And the next one says, what changes do you suggest could resolve these barriers? Well, the obvious answers are lower cost and increased access, and those are the same answers that you hear with traditional health care. How do we get more people on the Oregon Health Plan? How do we get more pregnant women to get prenatal care? Well, we decrease cost and improve access. The next question is, how did the 12-inch plant limit develop? That actually came about from commercial growers who informed us that in some nurseries, if a plant is above 12 inches, it's considered viable for commercial purposes. But if the plant's below 12 inches, then it's less likely to be viable. So the 12-inch rule was set up that if the commercial plant, not just marijuana, but if the commercial plant gets above 12 inches, then it's considered viable and the commercial seller is more likely to be able to sell a plant that's not going to die. It says, how well are the patient's needs met with the current limits on the size and the number of plants? I'm not sure there's a limit on the size of plants, except that if you make your plants too big and you grow them outdoors, people rip them off. That's a really big problem. But the number of plants, the way they are right now, is if the grower does everything perfectly, then they'll probably do okay. And if they can get a female clone instead of having to use seeds, because if you use seeds, the marijuana plant is a dioecious plant, but it means there's boy plants and girl plants, and that the male plants, marijuana plants, are not valuable. They're to be thrown out, or they're to have their pollen collected so that you can further the strain. But the male plants, and with no allowance for male plants, now it's easy for me to tell the difference between a male and a female plant, but you know it would require extra training for some. But the number of plants has given us problems because there's no allowance for the number of male plants, and that really makes it difficult to grow from seed. With regards to patients experiencing difficulties finding an MD to sign the recommendation, how can we make the program more accessible for patients with qualifying conditions? The best thing is to always talk to your physician. I think that educating the physician, for example, that physicians are now allowed to talk about Schedule I drugs without any fear from the federal government, the U.S. Supreme Court case came back in favor of physicians, so that physicians don't have to worry about talking about medical marijuana. In Oregon, all the physician has to do is say you have a debilitating condition and that medical marijuana may help. They don't even have to make a recommendation. So you try to go through your primary care physician, but if patients are worried about confidentiality, I've learned that's what all these clinics are for. You've heard of the medical marijuana clinics. There are certainly some in Portland and Eugene and other places. What I found out when I was testifying in another physician's defense is primarily what these are used for is I don't want my regular doctor's records to go to my employer, so I'm going to go see the medical marijuana specialist, get it okayed, and then it won't be in my regular doctor's chart. So that's a long answer to that question. There's only two more. Have there been attempts to add any other qualifying conditions, and if so, how successful have they been? There was an attempt in 2000. Agitation from Alzheimer's disease was added. I tried very hard to get anxiety added because of a lot of veterans with post-traumatic stress syndrome who use cannabis, and I trained at the Veterans Hospital, so I'm biased towards helping veterans. But we were unsuccessful to get anxiety through. So we had about 8 diagnoses, something like that, and we managed to get one through. So how successful have they been? Not very. But we did add one. How can patients expect to be helped by the actions of the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana? Well, I hope my testimony this morning will answer some of that. Mm-hmm. We hope that the Advisory Committee is not only going to be giving advice to the Department of Human Services, but we also know that with the electronic era, by the time that any of us get home from our meetings, what we say at our meetings is already going to be on the Internet. So I think that will influence voters in a way that maybe even goes beyond the intentions of the law of the advisory committee, because the advisory committee, there's the Internet out there, and now the advisory committee can become little publishers, and we can tell people what we're doing. Did I answer your question, Senator?
Thank you, and actually it's just questions that people have brought to me.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank the chair for allowing the... extension of the testimony for that.
Okay. Now, how well are your advisory committee meetings posted for the general public to give input?
They're on the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program website.
Mm-hmm.
So at the place where I think you click on the public meeting link, and then they have the meeting, and then they have the entire list of the advisory committee, and then all their email addresses are right next to them.
Okay. So now, I guess part of that question is, what kind of testimony do you actually receive from the general public?
At the advisory committee?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, this is going to be our first full meeting coming up, and we will have reports, of course, from administration, and then we will get public comment from the public, and then we'll have a time where we go into a work session. Tomorrow our work session is actually going to be having a discussion with the director of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services and the co-chair of the Governor's Council, so maybe they can educate us about how this domino effect came about, and if there's any chance that we may be able to get that medical marijuana part removed. That's what I'm really aiming for, I don't know how successful I'll be.
Thanks, Chair.
Yeah,
thank you. Dr. Baer, I think we looked at this commission not just informing the department but informing the legislature as well. And I would say, number one, that just because the governor's council recommends something doesn't make it so. And so my hope would be that you would take an official position.
Yes.
On that recommendation. I know that a couple years ago we stole money from the program, which is something we're very good at doing, it appears, to do other things. And I've always had issue with that. We did have issues with that when it happened, and of course we didn't win that battle. So I agree with a lot of the points you're making, and I would hate to see this program being used to fund other things. And so I'm hoping that we can have your position as officially to kind of back us up when we meet again in January.
Dr. Higginson, could you address that issue, please, in your philosophy of setting the fee?
Chair Morissette, certainly. Our feeling as administrator for the program is that these fees should be used for the program and should not be subsidizing others. That's the direction I believe we've been given for all of our fee-supported programs. Of course, if the legislature decides that there's going to be something else done, we will follow that as well. One of the things that we are going to talk about next time is at the meeting tomorrow is how we might keep from getting to an excessive cash balance that we experienced last legislative session, and so had that money taken away. I think that as responsible administrators for the program, we need to make sure we have enough cash balance so that the program is solvent, but not so much that it's excessive and might be seen as additional resources.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've seen this happen not just here but in other places where we have a program that the fees for the program are excessive of what the program needs. We just take the money and do other things with it rather than reduce the fees for the program. And that's counterintuitive to me, and I don't think the way we should be doing business.
Okay, good. Thank you. We're running out of time. Madeline.
Yes, good morning, and thank you all for allowing me to present to you today. I'm a registered medical cannabis patient, a caregiver, and the executive director of Oregon Normal, the Oregon chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. I've been a patient advocate and since the inception of the OMA. I meet with between 250 and 300 patients, sometimes more a month, to offer safe access to excess medicine as well as plant starts. I'm here today to talk to you about the successes of Senate Bill 1085 and the future improvements to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program as a viable patient-serving DHS program. And I've listed in my testimony there have been some positive results with the implementation of Senate Bill 1085. Particularly, patients are allowed to have more cannabis on hand, seasonal growers can remain within the law and produce an annual supply, medical and hospice, this is the one that's dearest to my heart, caregivers may assist their patients with administration of cannabis. The terminally ill, big thing, and frail can reap the benefits of their medicine. The privacy of patients and caregivers is more carefully guarded. Law enforcement has 24/7 access, which was a really big concern over the weekends, patients being disrupted and stressed out because law enforcement stops and visits without checking with DHS. A formal advisory committee has been formed to codify the existing process. In important areas for improvement, these are the ones that really stick out in my mind. Law enforcement needs training and direction to provide equal interpretation of the act throughout the state. This becomes a problem. Failure to train continues to cause patient stress and waste taxpayer dollars. In Lane County, $70,000 was lost in a verdict to a patient, and that's a big concern. Columbia County patients allege that Sergeant Edwards of St. Helens City Police is confiscating hash oil, where it clearly states in statute that hash oil or any preparations or mixtures are allowed. And, of course, the state police, I must say, are the best trained, and I'd love for them to offer that training to the other jurisdictions that are misinterpreting our law. Medicine for patients. You know, most patients cannot provide their own medicine, and that's a huge problem. It remains the biggest issue faced by many Oregonians. The attached letter that I've included in my testimony here is from a patient who contacted National Normal with her concerns and the difficulties that she faces. So we need a dispensary monitored by the state to provide safe access to the medicine that patients need. Cancer patients who are advised by their physicians, their doctors, tell them to go look for medical cannabis because it's the only thing that's going to help them with nausea. They have no place to go. People contact me on a regular basis and say, I will be facing chemotherapy in 2 to 4 weeks. Where would I get medicine? Where can I go and procure this? I have nothing to offer them. I have my finger in the dike giving a gram to patients a month. And that's just barely enough to survive for one day.
Excuse me, Mr. Yes. Chair, may I interrupt? Yes. And ask? Yes. I need to be clear in what you just said. Patients contact you who have not started the chemotherapy but are anticipating nausea?
Correct. Well, the physicians tell them you're going to experience nausea. This is part of what goes on, generally speaking, and the thing that can help you now is medical cannabis with the nausea. And they're looking for, where do I go? What do I do? And in some cases, they've started chemotherapy and are experiencing the nausea, and they are looking for medicine. So that's the biggest problem there. We would love to see a state-run dispensary, and I think that we could help by patients that could afford to procure their medicine from the state would then be able to subsidize those less fortunate or lower income that cannot pay for it. And I think it would help the program as well as fund human services in some cases and drug rehab or treatment. And we need to clarify and modify the plant definition. The description right now is anything over 12 inches high or wide is considered a mature plant. That is not really nature's way. And unfortunately, if you put a 12-inch plant in to a flowering cycle, you get a little plant. You get a little bit of medicine that really doesn't help you when you can have 24 ounces of usable medicine. It makes more sense. One of the things we're trying to eliminate for patients is the stress in your life, whereas this increase, fourfold increase from 3 ounces to now 24 ounces is very helpful because patients don't have to stress and worry about where that next little bit of medicine is going to come from. But we definitely need to define a vegetative stage. That would be, my recommendation is to take of the 18 plants, take 6 of those and put them in a vegetative stage where they are over 12 inches but are not flowering, to make it clear that they are not mature, they are immature, they are just over the 12 inch rule.
Now, you're going to be, those are the kinds of things that will come before the committee.
I hope
yeah.
so.
Now, Senator Cruz, you had a question.
I'm concerned that hash oil being usable marijuana, 24 ounces of hash oil is a rather large amount, and I guess from Dr. Higginson, this kind of came out of left field to me. I didn't consider that fit in the category of usable, because if it does, I remember from decades ago, that's some pretty strong stuff, and 24 ounces of hash oil would be...
Comments.
Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, this is really an issue that's outside of, you know, the registration program's jurisdiction. So, and we would clearly have to get legal counsel's viewpoint on this. I'm not sure that 24 ounces, the way it reads is 24 ounces of usable marijuana. I'm not sure that automatically translates into 24 ounces of any usable preparation made from medical marijuana.
Well,
but, again,
if
I can't.
If we're talking mixtures, I mean, obviously, like I said, we're going to revisit the issue, but there are some.
Yeah.
I think every time we solve one vagarity in this, we create three more, sort of thing. So I'm another thing on recommendation, I think, because clearly. Marijuana in its natural state and hash oil are entirely different things, but if we're going down the road to an interpretation, we may need to draw another line there. So,
and Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, if I could add, I know that one of the issues for state police, and Mike Dingman may be talking about this when he gets up, is the whole issue of drawing lines, drawing clear lines, and that was one of the reasons why the 12-inch rule came into effect, so that law enforcement had something clear, and I think the more clarification you can get on what 24 ounces of usable marijuana is going to be helpful to law enforcement.
That was clear, bright lines.
Yes.
That was kind of drummed into our heads when we were going through this. Okay, good.
I wanted to just point out that I've attached a letter here from a patient who contacted National Normal, and it explains this is what many of our patients face, the inability to afford the program as well as the inability to access safe medicine. And all of them are forced to the black market, and that's what we're trying to avoid here. We don't want patients out in the black market because they're getting inferior quality and they're actually being ripped off.
Now, the only way that we would ever move toward a central growth site and be able to establish funding eventually would be to say that we're going to do this legislatively and that there would be money set aside, which I was kind of hoping we would have had if we had lost it all. And so it's kind of dangerous to run up $1 million surplus and then suddenly have it taken away. So I think we have, you know, to me, that would be the ideal solution is a central growth site.
Yes,
you know, I mean, that would cause, you know, get rid of a lot of problems. I don't know if it would, you know, probably cause some, but it would certainly get rid of some problems. And it would have to be funded by fees from patients and so on.
Exactly.
And there would have to be a reserve fund that would build up for that. So, I mean, that's something that I guess your committee can talk about and we can consider, but it's been suggested before. There was a bill a couple sessions ago to establish that. So, okay, pardon me.
Was there a bill?
No. I think it was Representative Jeff Krupp who
introduced
the bill. Yeah,
okay. 2003.
And if his land is available, why not?
There's got to be some vacant state land out there. Come on.
Okay.
I've got a few acres and I'm not using.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you all.
The next panel of Lee Berger, Stormy Ray, and Lieutenant Mike Dingman, would you please come up?
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, could you tell me what was the excessive amount that was in the fund?
I believe it was a little over $1 million.
It was $990,000 or something like that. It was nearly a million.
It was ballpark $1 million.
Okay, we had $1.2 million, and I think they took $900,000 of that, I believe. Okay. Stormy, do you want to lead off? Okay.
Sure,
Lee, do you want to start?
Well, I'd love to hear from Stormy first.
Okay.
Oh, my.
Oh.
Well,
Thank you very much, both of you. My name is Stormy Ray. I'm the grandmother that helped to bring you the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act in 1998. I am delighted to be here today to report some very good news on what Senate Bill 1085's passing has done for Oregon patients. Let me begin by saying, front page, everybody. This is what it's all about. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all the relief this great program has given to the Oregon patients. I want to say a special thank you to Senator Bill Morissette, Senator Jeff Cruz, and Senator Przanski, and all the legislators that made Senate Bill 1085 possible. Thank you from all of us. Oregon has created the best medical marijuana program in the United States. Since Senate Bill 1085's passing, patients have ownership of their medicine and their gardens. Patients can now keep an adequate supply of medication, although I still receive calls from patients trying to find medicine. I'm happy to report the number of calls, and after answering the telephone line for 6 years, the number of calls are down. And it's the most wonderful thing. You guys are putting me out of business, and I just love it. The good news is that many patients are reporting that this new law has made it easier and less expensive for them to have their gardens. I would like to start by offering something that you may not have seen, and that is the next page. It's a picture of what a patient's garden can look like now that we have Senate Bill 1085. These are 6 mature marijuana plants that were harvested on 4/29 of this year. Out of those 6, the equipment used, I've listed everything there that was involved in this particular garden, and the estimated cost is just under $2,000. Now, this is a setup for the garden. This equipment will be used over and over a different harvest, but that's basically what a patient is looking out for, a setup of a good garden. Then you have your growing costs on top of that, which include your electricity, your soil, your nutrients. And you're probably looking right at $500 for a harvest cycle, which is going to occur in about 4 months. This garden yielded 37 ounces of dried, usable medical marijuana. Underneath, down below this picture, we've listed the different stages that this garden went through. And, of course, the very bottom picture is our favorite. Now, this is a lot more medicine than the 24 ounces. And this picture, it doesn't have all 37 ounces in it. There were, I think, 6 trays, 1 tray for every plant that was harvested. So the picture doesn't show all of it. But after we capped the 24 ounces, we were able to help a lot of patients with half and full ounces to get them food to where their harvest occurs. Many people haven't even been able to establish a garden yet. Where's my script? Okay, we're going to lose a little bit here. I do want to mention the fact that this setup and maintaining a garden is not something every patient can do. But we have had some wonderful things happen out here in the way of patient networking. We have patients coming together. Maybe somebody has the space. Maybe somebody else has some of the equipment. Maybe somebody else has the time. Between the patient and the caregivers and Senate Bill 1085, we're seeing a very positive change out here. I do want to address just a few issues of concern. The number one concern for me and I think it affects the program over and over again, has got to be the lack of understanding what Senate Bill 1085 is. Patients are confused about the new limits, definitely confused about growing. I hope my pictures help. And how to stay in compliance. Senate Bill 1085 was not able to provide a user-friendly information to cardholders. I would still like to see a manual like the driver's handbook that we all get when we learn to drive created that could explain our new law in easy-to-understand language. Lieutenant Dingman has graciously offered to investigate if a law enforcement pamphlet could be created that would guide patients through some of the confusing areas of our new law. This pamphlet could explain a patient's rights and responsibilities as a cardholder. My second concern is the next six clowns, and we just barely touched on it in an earlier testimony. For patients to have new plants to replace the ones that are about to be harvested, clones should be taken from the mother plant before it starts to flower. The latest date when a patient can take clones of a mother plant is 2 weeks into the budding stage. It will take about a week for the clones to root. Within 4 weeks, patients should be able to choose six of the clones to keep and begin giving the others away. So it's only the six that we're concerned about being too tall and out of compliance or over the 12 inches before the harvest occurs, and then they're put into the next garden for the plant stock. I have already discussed this problem with Lieutenant Dingman, and Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation is preparing a letter explaining this problem so that officers can better assess if a garden is trying to stay in compliance with the law. And I am also concerned about the Oregon still has marijuana listed as a Schedule I drug under our Oregon state law, when it clearly says under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act that it has medicinal value. This conflict in our law needs to be addressed. Just about done. The next page. This is just for your reference. I've attached the newspaper articles. One of them deals with pot smoking not linked to lung cancer. One of them deals with a new strategy for treatment of liver fibrosis. And another one, Israel researcher lowers blood pressure with cannabis component and wins an award. If you have a moment, please glance through those. Just for your reference, we now have 12 states that have a medical marijuana program. Actually, 11 states and one province. But it's still, it's a good thing here in Oregon. And last but not least, I would be amiss if I did not say thank you to Lieutenant Craig Durbin for championing Senate Bill 1085 on behalf of all of the patients. I have worked in law enforcement for a long time and been on the governor's advisory board, but this gentleman so went beyond the call of duty to help us make this happen for patients. So I truly want to say thank you. And I want to say thank you to Dr. Higginson and the wonderful Oregon Medical Marijuana Program staff. We did not give them an easy job, and they have done a wonderful job with it. Thank you.
Okay. I believe it's Captain Durbin now. Right. Very good.
As it should be.
Okay. Now, you will take your concerns to the advisory committee, I'm sure. The conflict in the law, I think, is something that needs to be addressed. Okay, thank you. Lee?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. My bar number is 83020. I've been practicing for 23 years. I am a member of the National Normal Legal Committee. I serve on the Board of Advisors of Americans for Board of Legal Advisors for Americans for Safe Access, an Oakland-based group. And in my capacity in those two organizations, I co-authored a brief in the Supreme Court on the Oregon Supreme Court on the Washburn case, which concerned employment and medical marijuana use. I'm hopeful that the decision in that case will obviate the need for any further legislation, although Ms. Martinez has shared with me her proposal, and I support that. I think that would be a good idea. In fact, I support her proposals in their entirety, except as to the reciprocity suggestion, and I would encourage the committee to adopt the language from the ballot measure 33 that we drafted, giving full faith and credit to the laws of the sister states so that patients who are traveling and visiting in Oregon I'm aware specifically of one case about a Californian who was stopped in Marion County who went to trial and was convicted and, was a legal patient both in California and then subsequently in Oregon because he was moving here, but he was unable to assert that defense as a consequence.
Excuse me. Did that person have a California card?
Chair Moore said in California, there isn't a statewide registry system. Left up to the counties and cities, and some do, some don't. And it wasn't my case, and I don't know for sure.
Full reciprocity would be interesting if the rules in the states are different. It would be it's something that needs to be discussed. But
I'm sorry to interrupt, but in that regard, I had discussed it last session with Mark McDonnell, who's the senior deputy district attorney in Multnomah County for the drug unit of that office, and Mark thought that if the limits were no different than the limits in Oregon, that it would be something, that he could endorse. I can't speak to the Oregon District Attorney Association's position on it.
Mr. Chair, point of clarification. Could you please explain to me what your case was about that had to do with employment and what the final verdict was?
Certainly. Chair Morissette, Senator Verger. It wasn't my case. A lawyer named Phil Labenbaum represented a patient named Robert Washburn who was fired because of his off-site use of medical marijuana, and the issue had to do with whether under the Medical Marijuana Act, with whether the company was discriminating against the person based on the Oregonians with Disabilities Act. The trial court had allowed summary judgment for the company. The Court of Appeals reversed. The Oregon Supreme Court ultimately held that the lockstep provision that requires that the Oregon Disabilities Act be read in conjunction with in lockstep with federal law meant that the person's disability, the inability to sleep without using cannabis therapeutically, didn't qualify as a disability under federal case law. And for that reason, there wasn't discrimination against that person. One judge concurring in the, one justice, Justice Kistler, concurring urged that the Controlled Substances Act superseded the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act in any event. But there was legislation last session that was offered in the House. I think it passed out of the House, but didn't go anywhere else. And one of the issues was, one of the concerns, certainly among patients and advocates, is that that was going to come back this session. And my hope and expectation is that the proponents of that bad legislation would be satisfied with the Supreme Court's decision. I hope that answers your question.
I'm sorry. We're waiting for Bowie to come up with their take on this, the Attorney General and the Bureau of Labor will come up with kind of a summary and a status report on what that bill does, or what that decision does, I'm sorry. So that's on its way.
Thank you, Chair Morissette. Initially, I was contacted by Mr. Bercovi and asked to present on what I've noticed about the implementation of the act. I'd like, before I do that, frankly, to respond to some of the things that have already been said. I'm a little disappointed that Senator Cruz left the room, because my recollection is that I testified before this committee that if we were going to be limited to four patients that a person could cultivate for, that that would be a deal breaker. And when I read the statute that said that if the patient or the patient's designated primary caregiver was actually present, that there wasn't that limitation, I understood that to be in response to that concern. And I'd hope that you would also pass on to Senator Cruz, Chair Morissette, that my experience is that the people who are cultivating for multiple patients more than four are people who are cultivating for people in hospice care or situations where more than four patients live in the same dwelling. And a rule restricting it to four, irrespective of whether the patient or caregiver is actually physically present, mm-hmm. would mean that there would be people in hospice care that weren't able to get their medicine, and it would mean that people who, by virtue of their living situation, the fact that they live with multiple patients, wouldn't be able to get their medicine either. So, I mean, I agree in that regard that ultimately some sort of a dispensary system is appropriate. I disagree about the notion of a central garden, frankly. The United States government has a central garden in Mississippi. It produces medical marijuana that is to marijuana what Russian cigarettes is to American cigarettes. It's not very good. And I'm concerned that if there's just one central garden, that that's what would happen. I had thought that the committee's paradigm of creating a new category of person called a person responsible for the grow site, which I had understood the committee meant was a grower, but you didn't say that in the statute. And I appreciate your comments, Chair Moore, said about how it didn't, you know, a person can be providing care by cultivating and administering medical marijuana. It seemed to me to be kind of an intermediary step towards a licensed cultivator dispensary system. And frankly, what I would encourage you to consider doing, Chair Morissette, is to hold a hearing on if you were to announce that you were going to hold a hearing on dispensaries generally, and that you were soliciting ideas about for different kinds of things. I'm certain and confident that, you know, among Senator Cruz said that, you know, two lawyers have five opinions. You know, so too do two medical cannabis activists, certainly in Oregon. One of the most amusing things that's happened to me since the passage of 1085 was I got an email from a Portland State University a social sciences student who was researching this, and he'd listened to the tapes and he'd read the testimony, and he wanted to know whether it was a purposeful strategy on behalf of the marijuana activists to take contrary positions before the committee. And I thought you'd appreciate that.
Just to comment on a central grow site, I guess I have an opposite take on the value of that, because it seems to me that different strains of marijuana have different medicinal values, and that would be the one place that could be tested. And I would say in an ideal situation, you would have a variety of plants available, and that people could then have access to the one that does the most good for their condition.
Chair Morissette, I certainly don't want to debate it with you, but I would like the opportunity. I would be hopeful that you would be open to different ideas about different ways to accomplish the same
and
goal.
And that's why I want OSU to do that.
You know, I had heard that, and I appreciate that, and I think that's a fine idea, you know, in terms of as a location for it.
Do it.
But again, the part that was appealing to me was the part that is the licensing of cultivators to be able to participate in this. So, I mean, I guess there could be a central garden so long as there were different cultivators that were... I'm just concerned that there were...
Well,
I mean, I'm sure you understand my concern.
I agree with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, what's happened since the law went into effect? And one of the questions from Senator Verger's constituent is, have I seen an increase in arrests? And I haven't. I've actually seen a decrease in that part of my caseload. That's a good thing I can say about 1085, which, as you will recall, I opposed in its final form.
Yeah.
So what are the problems? I talked about that and that. I appreciated especially the chair and Senator Cruz's comments regarding the advisory committee on... Let me back up a half a step. I helped draft the Medical Marijuana Act. I helped draft ballot measure 33. I participated in 1085. I certainly helped facilitate some of the compromises that resulted in the final legislation. My view of medical marijuana as a criminal lawyer is, criminal defense lawyer, is that it is that the purpose of the law is to protect people who use marijuana medicinally from the criminal justice system. One thing that overwhelmingly Oregonians agree on, upwards of 80%, 90% are aware of the law, more than 80% agree that medical marijuana patients shouldn't be part of the criminal justice system and ought to be excised from the system. And so from my perspective, the issues that are most greatly impacted are the criminal justice issues or the patient in the criminal justice issues. In that regard, if the 24/7 thing is in place, why require a patient to carry a card? It's offensive, frankly. I think it's inconsistent with the notion that and in the statute it says that marijuana is to be treated like other medicine. We don't require morphine patients. We don't require OxyContin patients. We don't require anybody else to carry a card. And if they can verify 24/7, why require it? And that part ought to be repealed. The problems I see that weren't addressed last session that I spoke with Senator Przanski about last session that I hope you take into account this session are issues relating to patients in the criminal justice system. Specifically, patients are currently, and I know Senator Verger in Coos County this was happening, where patients who were charged with crimes were being denied the ability to use their medicine on pretrial release. Patients who are accused of driving under the influence, whether it's under the influence of marijuana or another controlled substance or alcohol, who petition and enter into diversion or sometimes denied diversion or sometimes denied the use of their medicine while they're in diversion. I met a guy at the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association conference who works with a group called Change Point. He says in their group they require that patients take Marinol instead. That's just not proper. And then I spend a lot of my time, I've been in Pendleton on this, I've been on the phone at this conference, I've talked to people from Coos, Douglas, and Wasco and Hood River counties about, well, what if you're on probation, if you're allowed to use medical marijuana or not. There's a decision from the Court of Appeals where they didn't reach that decision. The prosecutors are arguing conclusively establishes it against them. And that's false. And of course, the fact that the fact that 1085 allows patients to possess an ounce of marijuana, even if they've been convicted of offenses, strongly suggests that they be allowed to use on probation. And that argument, I think, has carried some weight. We already discussed the absence of reciprocity, but the point about the it being a criminal statute is the response from Dr. Higginson that their responsibility is simply to administer a registry system, and I never thought that was the intent of the law in 1998. I didn't think that was the intent of the law in 2005, and it's certainly consistent. It's certainly the first time I've ever encountered any bureaucrat anywhere who said that I'm not going to try and make sure that everybody who can be protected by my program is going to be protected, and instead said no, that's advocacy, that's wrong. Similarly, the program's lawyer, and I had understood from, I missed the first meeting of the ACMM that I serve on, the advisory committee that I serve on, but I had understood that bylaws were adopted or a mission statement was adopted that precluded creating legislation or proposing legislation or taking a position on proposed legislation because of an unduly narrow reading of the statute creating the alternative or creating the committee. And I appreciate the comments regarding that. The decision to administer a background check has had a chilling effect on people participating in the program. I think the situation that under Dr. Baer's good leadership, I think what we're doing about making sure that the fee won't be taken again is by making sure that we don't run up that kind of a surplus again. And I think also that if we're gonna be funding other programs, a way to do that would be from dispensary fees.
Time out.
Okay.
We don't have a copy of the mission statement from the first meeting.
I think the mission statement parallels the...
Well, okay.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
I guess it just seems to me that an advisory committee's purpose is to advise, and I don't see a problem with... I'm hoping that we will receive recommendations from the advisory committee to the legislature. I mean, that's what the whole thing is about.
And I greatly appreciate your time.
Well,
I can help you through it.
If we're going to consider any changes at all, we want to know what the advisory committee's recommendations are. And we would expect a minority report as well. I mean, we want to know what the feeling of and minutes of the meetings and everything else. I mean, that's why we established an advisory.
I'm looking at 475-303-3. The committee shall advise the director on the administrative aspects of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, review current and proposed administrative rules of the program, and provide annual input on the fee structure. One interpretation of that is that it limits it to that. I read it, of course, that we have to do at least that. Similarly, the next section says the committee shall meet at least four times a year, times and places specified by the director. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, the program's lawyer reads that to mean there can only be four meetings, you know, and there are these bylaws. Anyway, it is, as Senator Cruz pointed out, a problem with statutory language, which is ambiguous and capable of more than one interpretation.
I don't see a conflict, really, because we are giving direction to the director right now to let us know what's going on, and we want the minutes of the meetings, we want recommendations that concern changes perhaps to not only administrative rules but to statutes. I mean, that's so that problem's just been solved.
Thank you again for clarifying that, Senator Mercer.
Yeah.
Senator Cruz, while you're out, we had talked at a previous hearing about how if it was going to be limited to four patients, it was going to be a deal breaker, and I had assumed that the language that came out of the conference and whatnot addressed that, and I had also testified that the only situations I know where there are more than four patients being served are situations where the patients are in hospice care or more than four patients reside in the same location. Having said that, I didn't say when you were gone, and I will tell you now, that my advice to patients, caregivers, and persons responsible for grow sites is to not cultivate for more than four patients, because 4 times 6 is 24, 4 times 18 is 72, 72 and 24 is 96, 96 is 4 less than 100, and 100 plants is a federal 5-year mandatory minimum. So in situations where patients are cultivating for more, or caregivers or persons responsible are cultivating for more than four patients, I encourage them to keep the total number of plants less than what they need and to learn how to grow larger plants. I have such respect for Dr. Baer, I'd like to publicly correct him, but the decision that says that federal government can't interfere in a physician advising their patient about medical marijuana is a Ninth Circuit decision. The government petitioned for certiorari. The Supreme Court denied review. It's not a Supreme Court decision. It's Conant versus Walters, and because of Ms. Martinez's good efforts, she persuaded the OMMP to put it on their website some time ago, and you could read about it there. Concerning adding conditions, a psychiatric nurse, Ed Glick, petition the program to add a series of psychiatric conditions. Dr. Higginson denied the petition as frivolous. We filed for judicial review in Benton County, the county where Nurse Glick lives, and we are in settlement negotiations. I think we're going to be able to resolve it, and I think there are likely to be some kind of hearings, hopefully fairer hearings than the hearings that were held in 2000 on that issue. Lastly, I do need to address this. I'm not sure where the program is going with this, but you know, we did, in response to law enforcement's concerns, add a restriction on the ability to cultivate for people who are convicted of manufacturing and delivery, because law enforcement was frustrated that they would arrest somebody who would be convicted and then they could go cultivate. I have several clients who are, you know, cases take time to process. The crime occurred at a time when that wasn't the law, and now they're convicted. If the law is everywhere under the federal and state constitutions that it's ex post facto to punish for somebody for something that wasn't a punishment at the time, courts have taken different positions on what things constitute punishments. But I had always thought that the intent of the committee, after meeting with Ms. Williamson and Ms. Okel and others who had been involved in the criminal justice system over medical marijuana, had had been that it wouldn't apply retroactively, and if that was your intention, this would be a good time to say that.
Ex post facto laws are unconstitutional, I guess.
And right.
Well, I mean...
There's a dispute as whether it's ex post facto.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what we have to take a look at. And
I just didn't think the committee intended that. I thought the committee intended from this point forward, everybody who is charged with and convicted of something would have this restriction. Am I correct in that?
I believe that's true.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that clarification.
That's a legislative intent. I believe that's true.
That was our assumption in what we were doing. Yes.
Okay. And
good.
And then let me just check here. Oh. I have to share with you that in two of the cases that I have where people were over the limit, where they're not abusing nothing, the one guy was sick and didn't renew, and the other guy had a patient needs 14 plants recommendation and, you know, hadn't been completely up to speed. Both these kids are college students who are at risk to lose their, who will lose their student loans as a consequence of being unable to defend against the case unless the district attorney, in a show of compassion, decides to provide some alternative resolution. When you remove the ability to defend against a crime, and the crime is a drug crime, and the offender is a student, under the Health Education Act, the student loses his or her financial aid or loans from the federal government. And I just I'd be remiss if I didn't share that news with you. Senator Verger's constituent goes on to ask, what are your suggestions for remedy regarding the mature plant definition and the removal of the affirmative defenses? The affirmative defense should be restored, and the remedy that's suggested by Ms. Martinez, that I understand Ms. Silverwolf helped draft, is one that I support. How can we adjust the amount of dried cannabis allowed for patients with an outdoor annual garden so they can have an adequate supply of medicine without risk of severe criminal charges? The outdoor patients I speak to and cultivators say, you know, it's better having a pound and a half than an ounce, on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, realistically, the yield is much greater than that. We had suggested in ballot measure 33, 6 pounds, since that's what the federal government gives patients under the Investigational New Drug Protocol, and I'd encourage the committee to adopt that. And lastly, the question is, how can we protect the program supported only by patient fees from financial raids from other agencies? And again, under Dr. Baer's good leadership, the ACMM is making sure that the OMMP is, you know, regularly advising us about what the fee is so that we don't run up that kind of a surplus again. And unless you have any other questions for me, I'm always honored and privileged to come and speak to you. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
I want to talk with you later about the student situation. I'm not sure I understand that, but I'll speak with you.
I'm available to you at your convenience. Thank you, Senator.
We have about 10 minutes. So.
Thank you. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Mike Dingeman. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police. I'm the current commander of the Drug Enforcement Section, and I'm Captain Durbin's replacement. This is my first exposure in the public setting anyway with regards to the medical marijuana law. And again, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. During the last session, law enforcement came in with the goal of working towards making changes that would do what we were just talking about earlier, that clear, bright line that would clear up the areas of confusion and uncertainty that we were having with administering the law when we came across a person who was violating the medical marijuana law. And I think that the work that was done did accomplish that goal, at least from law enforcement's perspective, in identifying clear, bright lines that we could use to assess plant counts, the affirmative defense being gone, requiring that card to be in possession. When officers were encountering people with marijuana that were claiming to be under the medical marijuana program. The definition of the plants and the seedlings or starts, again, those are all clear, bright lines. My discussions with officers that have encountered situations since the law went into effect have made comment that it's made their job much easier in determining, you know, what's legal, what's not, and what's not legal. Although, what I would say is I do think it's still a little bit too early in the implementation of the new law to draw too many conclusions about what its effect is going to be long term. The reason I say that is, we're still going. It's only been 6 months in. We're still in the education process. We still got to. There's probably still people out there that really don't know, what the law is and that it changed and some of the complexities that go with it. And some of these cases, some like what Mr. Berger was talking about, law enforcement's going to encounter, and it's really difficult to foresee the different scenarios that we're going to be faced with. And as time goes on and we're faced with those and we try to apply the law and they go through the system, that's where we're going to vet out, whether or not the legislative intent was really accomplished through the statutory wording. And I've heard some examples as we've gone through it today where, maybe that didn't work out quite the way we had hoped. But it's going to continue to take more time in order for us to at least vet some of that out and apply it and see whether it worked or not. And just in closing, again, I'm going to keep my comments brief, is that, again, when talking to the detectives in the field, that when we have encountered a cardholder who is in violation, they are having an easier time enforcing the medical marijuana law. And I'd be happy to answer any of the questions that have come up that you may have for me.
Oh, Senator Bridger.
Thank you very much. You've heard suggestions that there be some change in the Schedule I ranking of medical marijuana or marijuana. And then you've also heard suggested that other people don't have to carry cards, morphine patients or OxyContin and so forth. If those things were to happen, how would law enforcement be able to have clear lines? Aren't those two things beneficial to you in being able to determine exactly where you should be in the law?
Well, not necessarily, and I think this goes back to what I understand a lot of the discussions were, and the compromises that were made and what some of the issues law enforcement was having is we're talking about marijuana that is a medicine that isn't being controlled through a pharmacy, through, the normal routine of a prescription drug. People are allowed to be to grow it in their homes, and they're allowed to transport around. They don't have the little prescription sticker like we're accustomed to seeing with other prescription drugs. So that having that card in possession is something that's very important to us. I think I heard there was, why do we need that if we have the 24/7 access to LEDs? Well, LEDs isn't always available to us. There are times when we come across a contact in the field and our people are going to come across a cardholder who has marijuana, doesn't have their card with them, and the officer's sitting there faced with a decision. Is this person telling me the truth, or is this just a person who has some marijuana? They have no way of knowing. They make the check, ledges down. They don't have the ability to make that check. And if the person has their card in possession, then we don't have that problem. We still have the situation where maybe a person is a new applicant. They don't have the written documentation in possession. Maybe it hasn't been entered into that database yet. And then they come into contact with law enforcement. So these are all just examples of why I really do think that they need to have that card in possession. And now, is there another half to the question?
Well, the other part was the Schedule I drug. I think that you were, what I was trying to kind of lead to is that those things are helpful to you, and that's what you are reiterating to me, is that the card is helpful. And having the Schedule I drug, does that muddy the water in keeping the lines not as clear, or is it helpful?
Well, this is the first time Chairman Morsett, Senator Berger, this is the first time I've been posed with that question, but just off the cuff, marijuana needs to stay with Schedule I because it's still a controlled substance. Just like other prescription drugs, they're all controlled, and they'll fall into a schedule, and then they'll be governed through the Board of Pharmacy on exclusions and various things on how they can be used and when a prescription is required and not, and how they can be used. So how marijuana is classified is at Schedule 1, and then from there, you know, you can enter into whatever, like we're doing now. It's a Schedule 1 controlled substance that you can't have, but we do have an act or a law that has an exception, a criminal law exception that allows you to use it if you follow the rules that are in the statute.
Mr. Chair, do we have time for him to address the other questions that the constituent asked? Are we running too close?
Well, we're running very, very close.
I could help with that last question if I could. Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, I know that the district attorney for Clatsop County, Josh Marquis, has publicly supported changing the schedule of marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, as has Brian Michaels, a prominent lawyer in Eugene, and anytime you got Brian and Josh agreeing on something, I think it's probably a good thing, and I certainly agree, and I'm always glad to agree with Stormy on anything, and so I'm glad we found something to agree on. I've neglected to tell you that I've had two other kinds of experiences that are non-criminal law experiences since 1085 passed. I have a land use case where the county is saying that it's not an approved use or a conditional use, and or it needs to apply for a conditional use permit or do a home occupation permit to be cultivating marijuana for other people, and so we're discussing that.
What county is that?
Clackamas, and the other one actually is in Coos County. I got a call from a guy who's been taking his mom medical marijuana in a cookie form to and. Just to digress slightly, that's a problem that's more acute than hash oil. Is it the weight of the cookie? Is it the weight of the oil that's in the cookie? And that's been litigated down in Josephine County, actually, under the previous thing. But anyway, in Coos County, the guy's been taking his mom, and the facility said, you can't do this anymore. And, you know, he's concerned they're going to kick his mom out. And that's because the Compassionate Oregon Medical Association insisted on adding the language that the facility could refuse to require that this happened. And so one thing you might think about doing is repealing that section also. Again, thank you very much for your time.
Why don't you go ahead and, Lieutenant, answer the other question for Senator Virgil.
On question one, it was from law enforcement's perspective, what are the positive and or negative results regarding criminal arrests since Senate Bill 1085 became effective on January 1, 2006? And I think pretty much to what I've already said. I think that when law enforcement's encountering cardholders that are in violation, that that the new law has been of a benefit to us, and that it's making it easier for law enforcement to understand what the clear, bright line is and what is a violation and what is not a violation. And I'd also believe that it's easier for our prosecutors, and when they're trying to determine whether or not this is a case that is good for prosecution, and whether it's worthwhile to move forward with it, as that the new definitions, as I had mentioned, are making that part easier. I don't have any examples of the negative side of anything that's happened with Senate Bill 1085 as of yet, and again, other than what you've heard today in terms of some of the technical issues that have come out. But again, we're going to need some more time. It's new. People are still learning about the law, and you know, there's various scenarios that we may be faced with that may bring something up that we didn't foresee or weren't aware of. And I don't have any information on the number of arrests or costs associated with any of those arrests, other than to say that there have been some arrests since January 1 of cardholders involved in grows.
Senator Gordley.
I have a question. It's not for this panel, and so if you want to continue with the panel, I can wait.
Any other questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, where I would want a clarification goes back to the report prepared for the governor by the members who sat on his council on alcohol and drug abuse programs. And we heard a reference to the report earlier, the so-called domino effect report, and the concern was about the increased medical marijuana card application and renewal fee. What isn't clear to me is whether the council was wanting an increase in fee for what's described as prevention, treatment, and recovery services. And it's not clear to me whether this is a fee to apply to an existing program or if this is a program to be established that would deal only with marijuana users who are addicted, not patients, but marijuana users who are addicted and abusers. It's not clear to me what we're talking about. So if we could get that clarification for the record, it would be very helpful.
Dr. Higginson, do you have some insights into that differentiation?
Chair Morissette and Senator Gordley, you know, I really shouldn't speak for the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, and I have not been a part of those discussions. However, my understanding from reading the report is that it would be a $150 fee charged to medical marijuana program patients, and then part of those fees would go to subsidized treatment programs. That was my understanding, but for true clarification, I think you really should be dealing with the council.
Mr. Chair, I would say that's probably the correct assessment of what was proposed.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the response to a point. I'd like to hear more, frankly,
okay,
from
we'll
council.
We'll ask our administrator to get some information for us.
Thank you.
I'm going to deviate from the agenda and ask Alice Ivancy to come up for just a moment. Alice has been calling me for a long time.
Yes, I have.
Yes, she has. And Alice, go ahead. In just a couple of minutes because we are running.
Not a problem. I do appreciate very much Chair Morissette and committee members for this opportunity this morning. The thing that I wanted to address is...
Introduce yourself, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Alice Ivany. I'm a medical cannabis patient in the state of Oregon. I also belong to Oregon Green Free.
Okay.
My concerns that I have heard mostly about, and I'm sorry I didn't have more time to prepare, I wanted to address the mature plant definition. And I've heard some testimony this morning that says that once it hits 12 inches tall, it's considered a mature plant. So in order to be in compliance, you have to be under 12 inches tall, under 12 inches wide with no flowers showing. And also, I understand that this came from, this definition is based on what the Oregon agricultural industry says a plant might survive at. This plant is not part of Oregon's agriculture. It's a tropical plant. It doesn't behave such as the ones that they're selling on the market. It's very, very difficult. I'm having a hard time myself adjusting, and I know other patients are, a lot of patients are having a hard time. I'm an annual grower. I started some seeds in March, and within 21 days, before I could sex them out because they were too immature to sex out, they were already at 12 inches. So I had to begin cutting them down. That stresses the plants. Then you have to put them through the sexing time, which takes a few weeks. And in the meantime, you've got a three-month period of time in order to complete your mature plant to its final stage. It's very hard on the plants to be doing this. I'm not an experienced grower. I tried to grow an indoor crop this year because I was not able to have my doctor's recommendation for double the amount because I'm an annual grower. Double the amount for me was six plants. I only grew six out of the 14 because to me, doubling the amount of allowable plants in flower since they all flower at the same time in the fall meant that I could have six plants in flower or double the three under the old OMA laws. So I grew six out then. But I also grew six what I called bucket babies. They were smaller, and I started them earlier so that by the time the plants that were outside to finish in the fall, before they started to show flowers, the other ones were done. So therefore, I could supply myself with an adequate amount of medicine. What I would propose and what seems to be a consensus amongst the patients in the state of Oregon that I hear from is to remain within the 24 total plants, but readjust, modify, if you will, the definition, meaning that we could have nine six plants under the 12 by 12 rule, nine plants vegging, or teenagers as we call them. That would allow six constantly to be rotated into the flowering room. The nine vegging plants would never be allowed to go into flower until the other ones were completed with their cycle. This would allow patients to maintain three mother plants at all times with which they could take babies from in a more timely fashion that would allow for better health and maintenance of the garden.
Okay. You're going to go to the meeting tomorrow?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. And you'll be able to present that.
Okay.
Okay. I'd like to see that in writing.
I can do that for you, sir.
Okay.
If it's okay if I email
each
of the members.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I guess I would suggest sending it to the committee in a minute.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, for the opportunity.
Okay, we're almost out of time. So we will move immediately to Pain Management Commission update. Kathy Hahn, Susan Wysinski. Ooh, high tech. Do we need to dim the lights for this?
Okay.
And Lieutenant Mike Bingman, thank you very much for being here. We expect to see you on a regular basis. Thank you. Now, Mike, you're part of the committee, advisory committee. Do you attend those meetings?
I wasn't able to make the first one.
Okay.
Finally.
Yeah, good. Good. Thank you.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, thank you very much for giving us a chance to present what's happening with the Pain Commission. I thought that I would provide a little PowerPoint to give you an update of what's been happening the last 4.5 years. And so we'll go through it fairly quickly since we're a little behind. Advances in pain medical treatment.
Kathy, I'm sorry.
I'm Kathy Hahn. I am chair of the Pain Commission. I'm a pharmacist in Springfield. This is Susan Wysinski, who is vice chair, public member. Advances in medical treatment with individuals, we're doing heroic things these days, and it's ending up creating a whole new group of people that have long-term chronic pain. So we have people that are surviving car crashes and other things that never did before that have horrible results afterwards. So we're seeing more and more people that have chronic pain issues. You should know that there are many studies out there showing that the number one reason for absence from work and seeking medical attention is pain. Huge toll in quality of life, lost productivity, and use of healthcare resources is because of chronic pain. The national cost is estimated at $40 billion. Okay, $40 billion per year in medical expenses and lost work time. So this is a huge issue. We consider this an epidemic. So in kind of going back to the beginning with the commission, Senate Bill 1141 created the Pain Management Program and the coordinator in 1999, and this was from a governor's task force. The position is currently held by Diana Norton, who can wave at you. Senate Bill 885 created the Pain Management Commission in 2002. This was sponsored and represented, of course, by Senator Joan Dukes, who sponsored all of our legislation early on. And our current senator is Senator Lori Mona Sanderson. We are charged, the Pain Commission is charged with the responsibility of developing a pain management program for providers. We are charged with finding ways to improve pain management services through research, policy analysis, and model projects. And most importantly, we represent the concerns of patients in Oregon on issues of pain management to the governor and the Legislative Assembly. We are a 17-member commission. We have nurses, we have physicians, we have psychologists, naturopaths, chiropractors, physicians assistants, acupuncturists, palliative care, mental health, healthcare consumers, patient advocates, and public members on this commission. And if you ever have time, Senator Morsett has come many times to it. It's a very interesting group, having all of these volunteers sitting around a table trying to hash out how to make pain management in the state of Oregon better. It's a very interesting group. We're also represented by one representative and one senator.
I'd just like to add that it's not a painful situation.
It's very interesting. Yes, it's very interesting. We have, the commission has created a mandatory continuing education requirement in pain or palliative care. We decided in one of our interesting sessions, 7 hours. Now, of the 7 hours, we have created 1 hour that's on the web. Now, it's interesting. Oregon is now becoming fairly famous for our pain commission. Diana Norton and I went to a continuing education program not too long ago with a nationally known person, and she was very glad to meet us and said that she's talking about us all over the country because we have a pain commission and we have this 1 hour that's accessible to anyone. And so we're beginning to make people talk, and we're becoming an example to others in the country. So we have 6 hours. So we have our 1 hour that we created that you can get to from going to OregonPain.org. The other 6 hours we have been very loose with and said you can go out and get whatever continuing education you choose as long as it is accredited. And the regulatory boards are responsible for keeping track of all of this, and there are 9 disciplines that are involved. Now, this is the first page of this one-hour mandatory program that we created. And so we're keeping track of it, and we have discovered so far that about 6,500 healthcare professionals have gone through the program and gotten their little certificate. And we estimate before the end of this program in January of 2009 that approximately 60,000 healthcare professionals will have had to look at this and get their little certificate. So it would be of interest to you at some point to look this thing over. We toiled over this for probably a year and a half, making sure that it had the exact language and all of the concerns that we have as a commission for pain management in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, may I have a question?
Yes.
Yes. Could you tell me who goes through the program? You said healthcare providers. Who do you mean?
The legislation created mandatory CE for doctors, nurses, pharmacists, acupuncturists, chiropractors. Who else? Who am I missing?
Naturopaths.
Psychologists. It's a huge number of healthcare professionals, and this sets us apart from. I don't know if you know that California has a 12-hour mandatory continuing education program, and that is only for physicians. So we are very different. Our intent is always multidisciplinary, and so we are making all disciplines pretty much. The only ones we've forgotten are dentists and physical therapists and possibly occupational therapists. So we're thinking about doing a cleanup bill this next session and adding dentists. I can't tell you for sure. I think dentists may have something to do with pain.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Follow up.
How many doctors have you had go through the program?
Probably less than
200. Would you respond, Kathy, on the microphone?
Okay. Chair Morissette and Senator Verger, we believe that about 200 physicians so far. We have had some lag in some of the healthcare professionals understanding that they have this mandatory requirement. So it's slowly getting out there, but we have till 2009.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Just to follow up on that, if I could, how cooperative is the OMA being?
The OMA? We had a representative Senator Chair Morsatz and Senator Cruz. We had a representative from the OMA. Unfortunately, he moved to Washington, and we are currently looking for another representative. And they, at that time when we had a representative, he was very cooperative. He was very helpful, and he was actually one that helped us figure out that it was going to be 7 hours of CE rather than 10.
Now, the OMA, they have to find a representative, right?
It's not mandatory.
Not mandatory.
Okay. Right. It would be a very good idea.
Well, Ms. Chair, I mean, you know, I mean, when we go back to the original, how many years ago was that task force?
Task force in about 95 or so?
No, it was later than that because I was on it. 96, 97?
97.
Yeah. And I was on it, and that was one of the big hurdles to overcome was not only physicians but the OMA and and their attitude and kind of the culture and at that point in time, and when we passed the legislation, we were hearing sounds from the OMA of cooperation and moving forward in it. So it's not just having somebody there, but they're doing their part to inform physicians of what they should be doing. And so that was kind of the point of the question is, are they being proactive? Is the OMA being proactive at this point in time, or just kind of not?
Chair Morsatz, Senator Cruz, we're working at trying to keep them engaged.
Okay. What I would suggest that Senator Cruz and I do is have a letter drafted to the OMA, just encouraging them that they.
No, and the nurses. I mean, I'll probably be to all disciplines just to make sure that.
Well, yeah. And, okay, so right. Could you do that, please?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Well, rather than, you know, go to the statutory language part,
right.
we want people to participate. We certainly want the OMA to participate, and I don't want them to just drag their feet. I mean, if they're not going to send someone, they should say so, but we would encourage them to
Chair Morsatz, we would also encourage someone from the Board of Medical Examiners to be interested in our group.
Okay. Could you
good point.
Talk to Mr. Bukovian to make sure that we include...
Absolutely. Them. Absolutely.
Senator Berger, I'm sorry, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Given the previous panel and discussion around medical marijuana, can you help me understand what the linkage is between that subject matter and the Pain Commission?
Chair Morsatz, Senator Gordley, I don't know that there is any direct linkage. We, as members of the Pain Commission, we probably all have opinions on medical marijuana. I certainly do. I'm a practicing pharmacist in Springfield, and I have many medical marijuana patients that do very, very well. So I do have a very strong opinion. But that is not really a subject matter that Pain Commission has looked into.
Now,
if you choose that we do, we would...
I guess I'm a little bit confused by your broad general statement of doing... You're a pharmacist, and they are doing very, very well. Is there a connection?
No, I'm saying... I'm talking about as a provider, I take care of patients. And I have many patients that have been on opioids and have switched over to medical cannabis.
I see.
But I am still their pharmacist. I'm still... I'm a healthcare provider,
okay.
And I do take care of these are my patients. I take
okay.
really.
I think that's significant because as a pharmacist who has filled prescriptions for various kinds of pain medication, then when a patient switches over to medical marijuana instead of what they are formerly getting, then you see. You're in a position to see the results of that.
Yeah, Chair Morris said I have seen very, very good results.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Because
yeah.
I think
yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's anecdotal. Well, I don't know. That's a little beyond anecdotal. I guess that's direct evidence. Of,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, the response is helpful in just trying to understand the nexus. There must be some linkage.
Yeah.
And just trying to understand what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So, Chair Morissette, we'll go on. We have, in all of our meetings, we've created a suggested pain curriculum that can be found on our website. We've presented two conferences for pain patients, so we are trying to reach out to both providers and patients. And we've had two pain patient conferences, one in Albany and Astoria, and we're going to continue on with these kinds of things. We've presented one conference for providers in Eugene. We've held one pain specialist roundtable in Portland with Senator Mona Sanderson. We have created some legislation. You probably remember we had Senate Bill 434 that added language encouraging multidisciplinary treatment. So, of course, this is something very, very important to the Commission, that all pain management be multidisciplinary. We removed a mandatory second opinion from the Intractable Pain Act. Now, some of the things that we are doing are suggested by the Wisconsin Pain and Policy Studies Group. I don't know if you are aware of them, but they're kind of a parent group in Wisconsin that looks at policies in every single state. And every year or so, they give us a grade. And the last time they gave us a grade, we had a C+. And I just received information that they have new funding, and they will be grading us again this year plus the next two, so 3 years in a row. And I'm very much hoping with the changes that we've done that we can at least kind of get up to a B. It would be nice to have a B. But they very much outline things that we should be working on as far as policy in this state. Senate Bill 435 attempted to increase the psychologist's scope of practice to include pain management. Now, we haven't gotten that one passed, but I would guess that you'll see that one again. Senate Bill 285 added acupuncturists and pharmacists to the original Pain Commission bill. That was last year, and so it could be that this year you'll see one coming out with adding dentists and physical therapists, because I think they should be in there. Our meetings have created very interesting dialogue. We've had Board of Nursing, we've had Board of Pharmacy, Board of Medical Examiners come and have some lively dialogue. We've had position statements put in place from all three. We've had the Attorney General's office come in and have some fairly interesting dialogue when we were concerned that there were issues along with death with dignity that might have impacted us as far as who was deciding what appropriate prescribing would be. Would it be our medical board and our state, or would it be the DEA and the state, the U.S. Attorney General? We've had the state police come in and discuss regulations and laws governing driving under the influence, because we do have many pain patients that are on chronic opioids that feel that they are able to drive with no problem, and so that creates a concern, because it is, as long as they're on them, according to the state police, they're considered driving under the influence. We've had a lot of patient and provider testimony talking about the difficulty of finding a physician in various parts of the state. Some areas are good. There are other rural areas that it just doesn't even happen. We've had providers testify that they have serious concerns and have had problems with regulatory scrutiny and other issues that are similar to that. So in the Commission's consensus on all of this is that the problem with pain management in the state of Oregon is that it is suboptimal treatment. Provider and public education is inadequate. Providers are reluctant to treat pain patients due to fear of regulatory board scrutiny, fear of being duped by addicts, fear of the DEA, fear of litigation, inadequate reimbursement by third-party providers, and not enough time to deal with extremely difficult cases. The problem that we perceive as far as the pain patient goes is there are multiple challenges for people with pain: inadequate availability of care, inadequate coverage by third-party payers, public education and public perception of pain management is horrid. I am going out on a Saturday and then again the next Tuesday, and I'm doing lots of continuing education for the public, just going over and over and over, what is the difference between addiction and physical dependence and tolerance and withdrawal? What does it mean for a patient when they go into withdrawal? Does that mean that they're an addict? Absolutely not. And I would say that 95% of the public does not understand that. Comorbidities for patients with pain result in the loss of jobs, housing, family, self-esteem, positive outlook, and many other things.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I'm Norma to Consumer.
Introduce yourself.
Susan Yasinski, Vice Chair of the Pain Commission.
Okay.
and I'm also one of two consumer members on the commission. And I could sit here and talk well into the afternoon to you about how pain affects the life of a person. But instead, I'll ask you to recall a Far Side cartoon where a cat was sitting on the floor looking up at a counter and trying to do mental calculations on what it would take for him to jump, and he had a lot of mathematical formulas going on in his head. And that pretty much represents what goes on in a pain patient's head. Every time we do something, we have to calculate how much it's going to hurt us. And that includes everything from mowing the lawn, from doing the dishes, from getting in a car and driving from Portland to Salem. We are indeed the damaged members of the tribe, and too often we're left behind. And that brings me to a question for the committee. Our statute gives us the task of representing pain patients to the legislature and the governor in the area of pain management. Was the legislative intent to create just a commission that would look at medical issues, or is our scope much broader? Can we look at issues such as underemployment for chronic pain sufferers? Because when you're not employed, you don't have insurance, and therefore it's difficult to get access to care. We've discussed this at committee meetings, but we really feel that we need some clarification on legislative intent here.
Senator Cruz, how do you respond to that?
I think, Ms. Chair, I think that's something that wasn't in original intent. So the original intent was to educate the public and the industry of what they should be doing that they weren't doing, and to try to get that happening. You're bringing up other issues that I think could be part of a fuller discussion. But to say, is that part of legislative intent, where you're saying currently it is not? So that would be something we'd have to bring up during the next session.
Okay, thanks for the clarification.
Senator Gordley and then Senator Rick.
Thank you very much. What is the ORS site for the pain commission? The staff know that.
Chair Morissette, Senator Gordley, I would just Google Oregon Pain Management Commission.
I want to take a look at it right now while we're sitting here. That's what I'm asking. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Wait a minute. We can't do this. You're going to have you're going to have a microphone.
Chair Morissette, it's 409.500.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. It's interesting. I was in a pain workshop at a conference, and a prominent legislator from the state of Arizona, a woman, who said she didn't want to talk about that in her home state because that she didn't want that to come back to haunt her, that she was on OxyContin for her pain. And she said, you know, I'm not addicted, but my body depends on it. Mm-hmm. And that was a differentiated that as her body, as you mentioned, depended on it for her to function.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, she didn't consider that an addiction, which people look at. So it was an interesting comment.
Chair Morissette, I take Vicodin every day. I take Vicodin every day.
Yeah.
I couldn't drive down here if I didn't have my Vicodin.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Lee.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to respond to the broadness or limited discussions of the committee. I certainly don't want to rain on anybody's parade. I was very supportive of Senator Duke's efforts with pain management. However, that was before I went through a very personal, hard year with a patient with pain. And you've got a long way to go.
Oh, yeah.
And I would say until you have accomplished more in the industry, you really don't need to broaden into anything. You have very limited knowledge of pain management in physicians, and they are some of the best, but they do not know. And what is happening today with people that have serious illnesses is that family members are managing the pain simply on trial and error. And even pain management specialists are not doing what they should do. So I just want to tell you, until you get a better handle on what is out there, I would not broaden my agenda at all.
Good point.
Chair Morsett, Senator Berger, thank you. I appreciate your comments. So the Commission's consensus solution is that we need to further identify the problem by the use of surveys and community outreach. We need provider education. We need tools. We need guidelines. We need improved reimbursement. We need patient access to care, education, addiction treatment if necessary. We need a societal education to correct misperceptions about pain, pain treatment, opioid use, and alternative and complementary treatments. Our current and future projects, we're going to continue with pain patient surveys. We have a provider survey that we're looking at. We have a consensus statement we are working on to offer to all the regulatory boards and interested associations that we can all sign on to. The Pain Commission sponsored pain education for providers, patients, and the public will continue. Continued collaboration with the regulatory boards. We want to create a dialogue with third-party payers to improve reimbursement. And we want to encourage improved healthcare training curriculum in the Oregon colleges to reflect the importance of pain management. So our conclusion is that we hope that we are creating a balanced public policy that harmonizes medical and regulation issues so that doctors can go out there and do what they clinically know is right and not worry about regulatory scrutiny.
Now, you don't have to comment on the person that I met in your pharmacy one day, unless you want to.
Chair Morsett, I have a patient that comes from another state that is currently being treated in our town because he can't find help in his own state, and he flies once a month to Oregon and gets treated, and is doing wonderfully.
That to me is a very significant thing, because in the state that he's coming from, he can't find a doctor who would treat him, and so he comes mm-hmm. here to a doctor and then goes to your pharmacy. That says
yeah.
a lot.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Differentiating between chronic and terminal, and are you putting any effort into palliative care? Because clearly there is differences there.
Chair Morsett, Senator Cruz, we have a member of our commission that represents palliative care, and so that's always one of our focuses. So we differentiate the two, but we involve, we're looking at both.
Yeah, and I know that's kind of almost, Ms. Chair, an expansion of scope, just to get the basic education out there first has got to be phase one, but and it's going to be such a culture change to get people to look at, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. and we're going to, the feds are looking at it now in Medicaid and, mm-hmm. and end-of-life care you know, for cancer patients when they use chemo for the last shot and it never works sort of thing. And, mm-hmm. you know, so I think there's a whole cultural thing, mm-hmm. big picture, that we're going to have to embrace and address in these issues. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Regarding.
Thank you. I respect very much and agree with the comments made a few moments ago by Senator Berger about where the Commission should place its emphasis, and that emphasis certainly is very much a part of the language in the statute. With that said, the language that currently exists says that as one of the Commission's duties, you are to represent the concerns of patients in Oregon on issues of pain management to the governor and the legislative assembly. And I don't read that language as precluding your looking at anything else. And I'm not an attorney, but I'm just applying my common sense here to a read of what is in existing statute.
Chair Morsett, Senator Gurley, yeah, we have looked at that, and it is very broad, and there are so many things to do that we are at times overwhelmed.
There are so many problems, and we have a volunteer commission that has been. There are many of us that have been doing this for 4.5 years, and I would say that I have spent well over 1,000 hours working on this, and this is volunteer. So I'm kind of glad that we just haven't folded. We're trying to do what we can with very little, but we've got some extremely passionate, dedicated people on this commission that we will not stop. We're going to keep going with this thing because we know that there are still extreme problems out there.
I just really wanted Ms. Yasinski?
Yes, ma'am.
To know or understand that you've been heard.
Thank you, ma'am.
And thank you,
Senator,
for making the drive. Thank you.
I guess what I understand Senator Berger saying is that when you have firsthand experience with a loved one who is suffering mm-hmm. terminal chronic pain, and you don't have someone around that understands that or can deal with it, a physician, then what do you do? I mean, it's very frustrating. And so that, I think, has always been your first priority, mm-hmm. hasn't it, is to make sure that physicians are not afraid.
Chair Morissette, are
addict someone to the drug and when they're terminal, that's, you know.
Our first priority, I think, the whole time has been to educate and change what's being thought out there, and to try to address the fears of the physicians. The number one bottleneck in this whole problem is not being able to find a physician that is willing to take care of pain. So then you look at that problem and you say, okay, why is this happening? And so if it's fear of regulatory scrutiny, if it's fear that this actually could be an addict that they're looking at, so that has always been our first priority, and we spend a lot of time looking at that. And so, of course, always when we come out of this, education is the first thing that we, you know, how do you change a culture like that? It has to be education.
Senator Berger, is that what you were getting at?
That is, and I think in my own case, we just self-educated along with the help of pharmacists and some other people. But basically, you really need to have physicians understand mm-hmm. that they need to be able to educate the patient and the patient's family. So much is trial and error, and I understand that, and so much is individuals and the way they respond, and I understand that. But I think there is a, I don't know what it is in your mention of fear. I didn't think about fear. Maybe that's what I'm seeing and didn't know that's what I was looking at. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly a strong hesitancy on the part of physicians. And so the family members become more active in suggesting and in trying to diagnose and prescribe, if you will, and practice medicine without a license. And so I think that you do have a real need.
Yeah. Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, it is interesting to note that the Board of Medical Examiners recently changed their position, their pain philosophy position, to add that undertreatment of pain will be considered as improper as overtreatment of pain. So, yeah.
That is.
It's interesting. Yeah. I guess everyone's already read this slide, so I won't go over it.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, we're almost on schedule. Gary Schnabel, Kathy, would you stay where you are, please? And Alan Turtle, would you come up? Is that not correct?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just, rather than put up a PowerPoint with only a couple of slides, I turned in a couple of graphics. My name is Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I'd like to thank the committee for an opportunity to present this morning. I'd also like to thank your committee staff, Mr. Bacobian, for helping coordinate all this and to keep our eye on the ball. I just wanted to mention that I also served on the task force that Senator Cruz mentioned a minute ago, the Oregon Pain and Symptom Management Task Force. He was Representative Cruz at the time, and I believe we had Senator Joan Dukes, and I believe that it was Grant Higginson that chaired the task force. And my memory is that it was a fairly grueling attempt to identify barriers and issues and some ways of addressing those. And one of the solutions was the establishment of the Pain Commission, and that's still working. The Board of Pharmacy has participated variously with the Pain Commission. We've been at different meetings and discussed the issue that's before us today on a number of occasions. Currently, the Board of Pharmacy is developing its administrative rules for the pain management CE requirements. Initially, the pharmacists were left out, and in the 2005 session, they were put in, and so we're just now getting those rules developed. And the Board of Pharmacy is also working on a pain management position statement with language acceptable to the board and to the Pain Commission. Hopefully that will improve our grade from a C-plus or B or an A, however we can go with that. Why are we here today? I have, in a short amount of time, I briefly want to touch on prescription monitoring programs, background a little bit, and about what other states are doing, a little bit of an update from the legislative session last 2005. I want to summarize what our proposal does and then talk a little bit about what we have done in the interim with our coalition. And finally, I'd like to urge the committee to move a concept for a committee bill at the 2007 legislative session. Background on prescription monitoring programs. We have presented this as a drug abuse prevention early intervention model. It creates a central database of the information that currently exists in pharmacies for the dispensing of controlled substances. That material sits in individual pharmacies all around the states, and it's not very usable for anything other than the pharmacist looking at that individual patient. It can't be comparatively evaluated for trends. So what these programs do is provide data in a usable manner so they can identify a person who was going to multiple pharmacies or a person who was going to multiple physicians. I provided you with the map that shows all the states that have active programs colored in purple. What you can't see on that map, but is described in another page, is all the states that have passed legislation but haven't got their programs established yet or have legislation pending. And that includes on the map Arizona, Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, Louisiana, Tennessee, North Carolina, and East Coast states, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Vermont. So this is really a mainstream program, and you can see by the map that Oregon is a little bit isolated by the surrounding states, and states have told me that they're concerned that some of their patients are coming over unbeknownst to their providers in their state to get drugs in Oregon that can't be tracked. And, of course, providers care for patients across state lines all the time. We're concerned about patients who are not following their physician's plans in another state and getting drugs in our state that they don't know about or can't track. In the 2005 legislative session, we introduced Senate Bill 180. It had a couple of hearings. We had a fair amount of discussion about those. It didn't make it out of committee.
Let me stop there for just a minute. I could see two reasons why someone would go to another state. One, to doctor shop, and the other, because they just can't find a physician in that particular state that would prescribe the adequate medication. So I don't know that it's necessarily a tracking reason why they come. I mean, I think there are. So I just wanted to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and we fully acknowledge that. And, you know, Kathy and I have talked about that in the past, too, and I know she has patients from other states. And but you're exactly right. Everybody that comes over here is not coming over to scam. They have physicians that are tracking them.
Yeah.
They have pain contracts with them. And they're, so I didn't mean to say that they all are doing that. So Senate Bill 180... And during the discussions, a number of amendments were proposed, but the bill didn't move far enough to get amendments actually tacked on. So later in the session, and Senator Cruz and Senator Gordley, working with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association, developed Senate Bill 1093, and that was really the language of Senate Bill 180 with the amendments that had been proposed earlier actually tacked on. That was really the best language we could come up with. But because it was so late in the session and because of other timing issues with federal issues and the Oregon Death with Dignity Act and the U.S. Attorney General, neither one of those bills survived last session. So, but the Board of Pharmacy asked me as their staff to make sure that this that we do this again, try it again. It's still important, and so that's why we're here, is to update you on what we're doing in the interim and see if we can keep this still moving.
Chair,
yes,
yeah, Gary. I mean, you're talking about us considering a legislative concept. Is that going to look significantly different from Senate Bill 1093?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I think it will be very close to Senate Bill 1093. If any language needs to be changed, it will be on suggestions from the committee or legislative council.
Yeah.
I liked it myself.
We think it'll be and I can briefly go through and tell you exactly what the bill does. I mean, Senator Morissette probably knows this. Maybe you do. You've been through it enough. But for the other committee members, Section 1 simply provides some definitions. Section 2 establishes the controlled substance monitoring program. Section 3 requires pharmacists to report and defines how and by whom the information can be used. Section 4 authorizes the Board of Pharmacy to receive grants, gifts, and donation or other monies. Section 5 establishes an advisory task force. Section 6 sunsets the advisory task force. And then Section 7 just declares an emergency and has the bill effective upon passage. So that's really, in a nutshell, what that bill does. The real meat of this program is in Section 3 that talks about where the information can go and how it gets there and how the information can be used. There was a lot of discussion about concern how the information might be used or abused, and so we put in what protections we could. We believe that the Board of Pharmacy has authority to have this information. The reason we're putting this in the legislation is put a package together that protects the information if a program like this were going to be established, and because the Board didn't want to do this without the legislative approval. During the interim, we have had two meetings of a coalition, what we refer to as a coalition, both have been at the Board of Pharmacy office. That coalition includes both the associations and the boards of medicine, dentistry, nursing, pharmacy, naturopath. Not sure who I might be forgetting. Also includes law enforcement at the table now. What we didn't have before the last session was law enforcement at the table, and everybody wondered what was happening. Now they're there. We've had Lieutenant Dingeman is our representative, and the meeting that he was not able to attend, he sent a representative. We also have the DEA at the table now, so this isn't a ghost anymore. We can ask some questions and hear from them when issues come up. So I think that's been a nice thing. We also have the Pain Commission at the table, and the ACLU has been invited but has not been able to be at most of the meetings. We've had discussions with them, and she's here to talk about her position. Our understanding now is the only opposition that we have heard expressed is from the ACLU, and we understand why that is, and we have looked at the bill and talked about ways, and there's just no way we can fix this to get their support. So we understand that.
Madam, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Thank you. Are there any other possible changes being considered in this group that you describe as a coalition? Or would those possible changes be coming? What happened to other places, ACLU or other places?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we have had one suggestion. We've had a number of suggestions, and some of them are things that maybe not, maybe don't belong in legislation that we can do with the by rule or by the advisory committee. One of the suggestions that stayed on the table at our last meeting was a suggestion from the Pain Commission about somehow having pain patients more involved in the task force, a consumer member on a task force, or and somehow the idea of whether the patient who is the subject of one of these reports back to the doctor should be notified when that doctor gets a report.
Okay.
We don't know if that needs to be in the legislation or whether that can be dealt with by the task force or by the rules that would be adopted by the board to manage the program. And there may be others as people start to look at the program and find concerns, but everybody looked at it last session, and we think most of the major concerns have been brought forward already. That's the end of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you have and more details about the program, how the information gets out, if you want.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think I'd agree that we, as far as the details on the front end, taking a look at the task force and seeing what adds we need to make, and during the last session at various meetings I was at, and we had conversations with law enforcement about this and with the governor's office about this and had pretty good support. So that might be potential adds we could do, and certainly some advocates might be appropriate as well. But that's an easy fix.
Dr. Erfeller, Kathy, we'll hear from you.
Chair Morissette and honorable committee, I'm Janet Preller with the Corvallis Clinic. Dr. Ertl sends his regrets. He had a family emergency. This is a very important matter to him, so he sent me to speak. I'm the patient advocate for the Corvallis Clinic, and I am the...
I'm sorry. Could you give us your name again?
Yes, Janet Preller with the Corvallis Clinic. Patient advocate.
Would you spell your last name?
Mm-hmm. P as in Paul. R-E-L-L-E-R.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I think you've all received a copy of Dr. Erdo's letter. Is that correct? You've had a chance to look through that. I'd like to respond to questions you have and speak to the letter. I'm the designated personnel that he references in the letter that is employed by the Corvallis Clinic.
Why don't you give us kind of an overview?
Okay.
Oh, here it is. Directly to us. Okay.
Senator Morissette. I personally at the Corvallis Clinic have managed 600 cases in the past 2 years where physicians have accessed me to try to help determine whether they're treating a legitimate pain need or whether they are the victim of a drug-seeking patient. I have a rather balanced perspective, I believe, in that I'm listening to these stories around the room today and even the testimony of Kathy Hahn with the Pain Commission, and I'm saying yes. This issue prevents patients from receiving the medical care that they need. When patients that are drug-seeking for less honorable reasons to profit, to sell, or to feed in an addiction issue, they burn our physicians out. Our physicians walk a tightrope of whether they are under-managing pain or whether they're over-managing pain. And they need reliable, objective information to make their decisions. The sad thing that I notice is that patients with legitimate pain needs become seemingly suspect because of the work done by those that are seeking for other reasons. This contributes to burnout of our physicians. We had an Albany provider at our Albany clinic call me 6 months into his establishing with our clinic, and he said, "This is not what I got into medicine for." There are those that watch the papers. They target new physicians. I knew that not every patient on his schedule was illegitimate. I was concerned about how the patients were being treated and what information we could provide that could help us weed through and really meet the needs of legitimate patients. Unfortunately, patients that are impoverished, lower socioeconomic status, they're the ones that may not be able to articulate their position well. They may be the ones that, Chair Morris, that you're talking about, maybe perhaps going to another state. I've seen, over my 13 years at the Corvallis Clinic, not only patients that are impoverished, that have drug-seeking patients, but physicians with problems. The scope of this is incredible. In the past 2 months, I've worked with a woman who was drug-seeking under her 94-year-old father's name, taking his pain medication, and had to involve the authorities. I've worked with a woman who had a gunshot injury to the head, who was impoverished, was fleeing a domestic violence situation, where she came to our state to seek protection. She was perceived as drug-seeking. She had no records with her. She got out of the state that she was from. She was perceived by our physicians as being drug-seeking. I was asked to help with this. We did a pharmacy check. Of course, that's anecdotal because there's no systematic way of finding out. But in my educated opinion, she was not drug-seeking. Patients with legitimate pain needs drug-seek when their pain needs are not met. So after she got in with a neurologist and she was being effectively managed, she was able to, the behaviors that were concerning were able to resolve. She was an incredible survivor. So I've seen both ends of the spectrum. Our physicians are victims as much as patients with legitimate needs. I see nothing, and neither does any of our 80 providers. Our board has voted on this to support the Senate Bill 1093. I see nothing that conflicts with anything that the Pain Commission proposes. It only enhances the care that pain patients will get. Reports are generated only on patients with problematic behavior, and it starts an inquiry.
Now, where does the inquiry originate? With a doctor that suspects, or with a pharmacist that suspects?
My understanding of the bill is that a physician can request the information from the pharmacist by providing the DEA number and the patient information, and also that a report would be generated when there's been the criteria have not been designated and it needs to be individual to each state, but they would get a report if their patient is meeting that particular criteria of multiple prescribers.
Okay. Now, and maybe Kathy Hahn will address this, but we'll, should we add something to this bill that says patients are notified that they're on a registry? That in a sense, would put people on notice that there is a registry, you're on it, you have protection. Only a court order would get the information, but you know it seems to me that would prevent some.
I personally have no issue with notification. When I meet with a patient, I do have them sign a specific release for pharmacies because I want them to know that if we need to, we will check, and that really helps resolve issues for for doctors. We want them to move forward in confidence in prescribing. I did attend the national conference in April of the Alliance of States that have the prescription drug monitoring program. And what I was very much moved by was the fact that each state had individualized their program to meet the needs of those that they represented in the state. And my concern in hearing the DEA speak is that the federal government is going to get involved if the states do not step up, and we may lose our opportunity to really design something that meets the needs of those in our state.
Now, let's go back to the release. So you, when you prescribe, tell me about the release.
Okay, Chair Morissette, when we have a new patient that comes to us without records, a physician will ask for my involvement, and I want them to know whether I use the release or not. I have them sign that so that they're aware. I believe under HIPAA it is our right to know. It's a need to know, and my interpretation of that and those that I've spoken with, it's need to know for a physician and keeping a patient safe. But I do it more as a gesture to have the patient sign the release so that they know that that is information that's crucial. So I'm representing what we do at the Corvallis Clinic.
Okay. I think Kathy Hahn was going to talk about this in a minute, but let's finish your...
Okay. We serve 47% of the residents in Lynn and Benton counties, if that gives you an idea of the community that we're working with. I heard Kathy Hahn in her presentation say that pain management was suboptimal in Oregon. I believe very strongly from my experience at the Corvallis Clinic that this is one reason. The physicians are walking a tightrope. They need information. Pain is subjective. When they have been burnt by a patient more than once, then they become much, much more cautious. I also think from a treatment perspective, I'd like to bring to your attention that 2 years into my working with this particular population, I did obtain my addiction counseling credentials through the state of Oregon because I thought that was necessary in knowing, you know, what we were treating and being able to identify addiction issues and facilitate treatment for those who needed it. And I see that this bill is consistent with meeting the needs. It would give us an opportunity to identify those with addiction issues and to be able to provide an intervention when it's most treatable, which is early in the stage of the disease, like many diseases. Again, we largely now rely on anecdotal information when a pharmacy calls us with a concern. And I've had many cases where we have had opportunities to facilitate treatment for patients. A gentleman comes to mind who worked for the state of Oregon in a leadership position. It allowed him to travel throughout the state. He was going to many physicians throughout the state, and he allowed me to refer him for treatment. Not initially. He was very angry initially. 6 months after my initial work with him, he called me at, I remember the voicemail at midnight when I came in the next day. It was left at midnight. And he said, "The work that you do at the clinic saved my life. The work that your physicians do saved my life." We're unique in that the Corvallis Clinic has determined that this is a worthy cause. They want their patients to be treated in a way that's with dignity and have designated resources for that. There's a lot of physician groups that don't have resources to hire staff like me and still need that information. I would like the opportunity for us to facilitate treatment for more addicts. I would like us to have the opportunity to move forth in prescribing for patients without fear that we're contributing to an addiction problem or even worse to some sort of drug diversion problem. I volunteer in our community in the schools. I speak on drug issues both to the occupational health class as well as the general health classes. increasingly youth are, I find that they're just more and more aware of what Vicodin is, what oxycodone is, what OxyContin is. Following the last time I spoke to a health class, I got an email from a young woman asking me, well, why was it a problem for her to party with morphine sulfate? Where are our youth getting these medications? They go back to the source. Somebody's getting them from the physicians. And so I think that the perspective that we have in our community is one that is useful in applying to the rest of the state, and I'd like you to seriously consider this bill.
Okay. Do you have a counterpart in other locations?
Just Lynn and Benton counties. The Corvallis Clinic proper is in Corvallis. We have a Philomath office and an Albany clinic as well.
Are you familiar with the Lane Independent Practice Association, LIPA?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not.
Seems to me that would be an appropriate kind of thing for them to be involved in, and I'll suggest it to them. I mean, it's a physician association.
Oh.
They are involved in a lot of things. But Kathy, you'll have to help me with that.
I can help you. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Morissette.
Very much.
Okay.
Yeah, Kathy.
Thank you, Chair Morissette and committee. I am Kathy Hahn, again, Chair of the Pain Commission. Do you want me, I have handed you a statement. Do you want me to just paraphrase and talk a little bit, or you want me to read it?
Paraphrase.
Okay. So last legislative session, the commission, Pain Commission, decided to oppose this bill. We were right in the middle of a very serious concern with death with dignity and U.S. Attorney General, the DEA, and there were many, many concerns that somehow government could get to this data pool and start picking off the docs. Now, since then, we've had a resolution to that. The Supreme Court has ruled in our favor, and that issue is off the table. So the commission has relooked at this, and it has given us time to interview lots of docs. And in our quest of trying to figure out how to fix this bottleneck of doctors not treating pain and not just the reluctance. And we're getting lots and lots of comments. Just maybe we would describe what this program is, and the doctors would say, if you could give me a tool that I could look this person up, someone that I think is duping me but possibly is not, this would be a fabulous thing. And there are many more patients that I would treat if I had a tool like this. So the commission we're very cautious about this because, of course, we're concerned patient privacy and creating a data pool at all. And we are worried that in this era of data mining, that even if we put every lock in the world on information that it could be gotten to. But frankly, the commission at this point is so concerned about under-treatment of pain and knowing that this is a tool for physicians and hearing the physicians tell us, give us something. We're not going to move forward at all until something changes. And the commission sees this as the change and the tool that maybe is going to take the first step.
Okay. Now, the physician then could do the tracking.
Mr. Chair, yeah, the physician can contact the program and get a report on any of their patients anytime.
Okay.
Also, they would receive a report if a person dinged the bell of more than so many pharmacies or more than so many physicians. He would get an unsolicited report for that. But anyone who's prescribing or dispensing could query the program about their particular patient.
Okay, now where is law enforcement? They need it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can't speak for them. They've been at the table, and my understanding from them is that they're very supportive of the program for what it would do. They don't see this, I'm paraphrasing again, don't see this as a tool that they are salivating for. It's not something that they want in their hands, but it's going to have a positive impact.
I asked the question the wrong way.
Okay.
What protection is there for the patient from law enforcement doing the mining?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we have in Section 3 of the bill is a requirement that other than the physician or the pharmacist, for law enforcement to get a hold of any of that information, it would have to be based on a subpoena, on a court order issued for due cause. And on my understanding, that's a fairly high standard for law enforcement.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Blair.
Thank you very much. Has there been an explicit conversation with law enforcement about this concern, this particular concern, data mining, that is the concern about law enforcement possible abuse?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, there have been a number of conversations with both the DEA and with law enforcement, and we hear that they have tools that they need and that this, in fact, will not be allowed to be used as evidence. It could be allowed with a court order for due cause to further somebody's investigation or show them where to look. But the documents or reports that come out of this database are not considered evidence.
Follow up.
Yes.
Are we aware of what the experience has been in other states around this particular concern?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, members of the committee, my understanding from the states that I've talked to is that there are occasional requests from law enforcement for this information. They are relatively rare, and there has never been, that I have been able to determine from talking with virtually every state that has a program, a reported complaint or event of abuse by law enforcement of this information.
And then another follow-up, if I may, for the Payne Commission. There's a statement in bold in your printed statement that says, with some skepticism and caution, the Commission is now in support of this monitoring program, providing the following modification is included. The program must provide notification of data collection to persons impacted, including the bed-bound chronic pain patient to the dental patient suffering pain from a root canal. Is what you're looking for that all patients, all persons would be notified?
Chair Morissette, Senator Gordley, what I am, what the commission is looking for in this statement is possibly a simple statement that gets printed out. I'm envisioning maybe something that gets printed on the patient's receipt when they get their drugs. And if the drug happens to be a controlled drug, the computer would kick in an extra statement saying, this is a controlled drug. You are this will be added to the data pool or something like that. And I think it could be a very easy thing to do, and it would help the pharmacist remember to talk to them about it. And I perceive this as not a barrier. This is something that just let's do this just to let everybody know. So it's not like some secret data pool, but something that anybody that gets something. So this would include the pediatric patient that gets Ritalin, Adderall. Something for attention deficit. Anybody that gets this, I think it's important for the Oregonians to know that there is a data pool. There's nothing. I don't think we should be hiding it. And
An additional question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. You're also urging in your written statement that there be a. You're strongly urging a public conversation about this program to alert consumers before it is put before the legislature. Are you suggesting a public conversation that is something different from what would happen during a legislative session when there would be public hearings? Are you suggesting a different kind of convening?
Chair Morissette, Senator Gortley, we were suggesting possibly having in some of the patient education series that we do, possibly throwing it out there, and just it's been very illuminating to have a conversation with physicians, because it's made us realize just how much physicians really do want this. And I think it's equally important for us to kind of do a survey of the state, and I think between the Pain Society of Oregon and maybe the Pain Commission, we could we can be out there and kind of talking about this and letting patients know. And I think it's important that we pose this in a, you know, let them know that we are thinking that this is a tool, and this could make physicians feel more comfortable to treat, you know, kind of come out from behind the, you know, the curtain and treat pain. And there needs to be a conversation about it, and I'd like to see it start before 2007.
Mm-hmm. That concludes my questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I see no problem with that sort of conversation. I see no problem with informing patients. That's common sense. And I guess during last session when I was working the issue, in my conversations with law enforcement, is they don't see this as a big hammer that they're going to use. What they see it is a way for the medical community to police itself, and so they have less to do. So, you know, I think that's important. You know, and I looked at the, you know, it was frustrating to me last session, Mr. Chair, quite simply that the opposition was from the Pain Commission, because I saw this as a tool that would help them, and I'm grateful that those conversations are finally happening, because I do think this is a tool that can help those with chronic pain be separated from drug shoppers, and which is clearly what we're after here, is to stop that sort of activity and have a clear record of it. And so readily admitting that nothing is ever perfect, and any system that's ever built, somebody will find a way to game it. That's just human nature. We know that. But having said that, I think this is a huge step in the right direction.
Okay, my opposition had to do directly with the Death with Dignity decision that was in the future when we considered this. That had not happened, and I still am not sure what the prerogative of... I sense that if the feds wanted to come in and prosecute individual doctors, they could do that. I don't think they're going to mess with the law. They did not overturn the law, but like even with medical marijuana, if the feds really, really want to get tough, there's nothing to prevent them from acting under the federal statute. Is that right?
Yeah, comment. That's my understanding, Mr. Chair, but I also would mention, though, that the Oregon Attorney General and the governor, in fact, have defended the Death with Dignity Act in the face of the federal government. They've shown that they'll defend Oregon state law, and we assume that they would do that with this.
Well, the prescription, in some ways, the medication that's prescribed for Death with Dignity is not your standard prescription drugs that you get over. You know, that's a separate category. Is that right?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, not exactly. They are a drug that's commonly prescribed. It's not prescribed in that way. It's a drug that would be used one tablet, one capsule at a time, not 100 capsules.
Well, okay. I understand that. Okay. So... I guess the federal government always has the prerogative to step in and prosecute even under the Death with Dignity. They could meet resistance, but I mean the federal law supersedes, and I didn't expect them to declare our law unconstitutional, no more than they declared the marijuana law. They're just sending a message.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to forget, though, which I did already once today, in Senate Bill 1093, one of the amendments we had written in was that the Death with Dignity, that prescriptions written pursuant to the Death with Dignity Act are not reportable, that the Board of Pharmacy can't require that report, along with the other controlled substances. I think that's in Section 2.
Good.
It's in the top of the second page. I also failed to mention that we have received a grant from the Harold Rogers Grant Foundation. This was set up by the by Congress in 2002, I believe, was the first one. We received $350,000 to develop and to implement and run the program for a period of about 2 years. We were able to get that a little bit on good faith. I convinced the grant administrators that we had a pretty good chance of getting this bill passed, even though it wasn't passed yet. The bill didn't pass, and the grant period ran out. We were able to get an extension on that grant period, again, based on the fact that we have a pretty solid program and that we're going to make a run at it again and have a good chance. So that grant was extended through July 1. We have to make a report back to the grant administrators July 1 to demonstrate that we are making some progress. And so we're hoping that we can have something to bring back from here. If we don't show action from this committee, it's not dead. It's anybody's guess. But if we have a positive action by the committee, they've indicated that they'll extend the grant period.
Now, what did you base your eternal optimism on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm just an eternal optimist.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to pin you down, though. If you could, what is the definition of progress?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, they didn't say. They wanted to hear progress, and we report what we've done, and they will assess that themselves and decide if it's worth giving us another shot. We didn't tell them details. They are aware of this committee, that we're making a presentation to the committee. They are aware of Senate Bill 1093. They know where we are in the process. So
it's scary.
Yeah.
And the amount of funding remaining is what?
We went to, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we went to the emergency board and were allowed to take $20,000 of that $350,000 to work on education and development. So we are still within that $20,000.
Okay. Kathy Hahn, now the bill as written doesn't contain some of your ideas, or at least the notification. You're suggesting that be included, is that right?
Chair Moore said yes.
Okay.
It seems to me that would be a fairly simple thing to do.
Okay. And Gary, what's your feeling?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not against it either, as long as we couldn't figure out how to write some of the ideas in the bill and that maybe they could be dealt with by the task force or by the rules. But with regard to notifying patients, that's fine, but I think patients will be notified anyway if a report goes back to their prescriber. You know, they're going to hear from the physician.
Okay, but I think even on the receipt, or you know, when the pharmacist consults with the patient, that would be a time to do it, but at least something on the receipt, I think there should be.
Sure, now, Mr. Chair, we also talked about the somehow a comment on the HIPAA form or a comment on the pain contract that people have. There are a number of ways I think that notification can be provided. I just didn't know if there's a way to write that in the bill or how to accomplish it, but we don't have a problem with the idea.
Mr. Chair, I think the bill only needs to reference the fact that it shall be done and leave the actual wordsmithing to certified smart people.
Well, I think the legislative intent needs to be expressed in the bill that there will be some notification and discussion. Now,
that's easy.
Ms. Hahn, you were talking about a broader discussion, which we don't have to put in the bill, but that wouldn't preclude that. So you see this as an opportunity to get doctors involved and educated, part of your mission statement.
Chair Morissette and the committee, yes. So we'd like to see something in the bill that just says, and I agree, there are many different ways we could go about notifying patients. And then the further thing is just, as long as all of us know that we should start this discussion now. We don't need to have that in the bill.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Now, I must say that when I was the mayor of Springfield and we used to have public hearings, I always told people that you don't make up your mind until you hear the last argument. Now, there have been times when I have been persuaded by the last argument. Otherwise, what's the sense of having a public hearing? So we are going to hear the last argument in just a moment. Did you have a something that you
want? I guess a final comment, that we have started an education process already, and I think just implementing this program will be educating the pharmacist and the physician around. So it's not going to be a secret, and we plan to include public education as well.
Just, Gary, before you leave, just a clarification of what Senator Gourley was talking about. I mean, do you think at this point in time, assuming some of our minds aren't changed in the next few minutes, that that just kind of a sense that this committee would be willing to consider redrafting 1093 as a committee bill would be enough to hold the funds?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe it is. I was hoping to report that we have a concept and a commitment, and that will be enough.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you very much.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think we do need to get some more definitive information from other states, how other states have addressed the issue. That may help us move forward.
How do you propose doing this?
Well, I heard Mr. Schnabel say in his testimony that he had talked to a number of states, but we didn't. I didn't probe further to ask how many states and exactly what specifically he learned. I think we have an opportunity to do that piece of research.
Okay. We did have, in the original hearing, the state of Idaho and the state of Nevada were represented by the counterparts of Mr. Schnabel.
Mm-hmm. But when you have, this is the big picture is you've got 30 states that have enacted something, around 30, eight where something's pending, and within that number, those numbers, you've got 23 operational prescription drug monitoring programs going on out there around the country. So there are some lessons that have been learned out there. Let's find out what they are and apply them.
Okay. Now, I think that's a great idea. So, Mr. Administrator, how do you propose doing that?
Chair, I will communicate further with Gary Schnabel to discuss how we might get that input back to members. We only have one more hearing in the interim for this committee.
In September.
September, potentially, though, this is a pre-session file bill request. Bill, if this does go into session, that might be an opportunity to bring in people during the regular session.
Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Gourley that more from, but I don't think that precludes the concept at this point.
I don't either. I'm just asking for something like a survey through the National Conference of State Legislatures.
A pre-session file bill may not end up the way it's written. I
that's
mean,
right.
We can add and subtract and so on and so on. So that, that makes sense. Andrea, would you give it?
Chair Morris, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. I don't know if I'm going to beat your pain or cause your pain today, but I am here and I do appreciate the chair inviting my testimony, and I appreciate you're all considering that as you look at these issues. The ACLU of Oregon does strongly oppose this proposal before you today to create a government-controlled electronic pharmacy database, and we are quite alarmed by the ramifications such a proposal has with the privacy of Oregon residents when it comes to their personal medical information and medical care. You know, the word privacy means many different things to different people. As described by former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis in 1890, quote, it is the right to be left alone. In court cases, the right to privacy has been described as, quote, the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized man. So this cherished right is now under attack, and one of the primary culprits is the government and its desire to use the advent of technology to monitor our activities. And it can be very well intentioned under the guise of helping us, but the practical effect is to slowly erode not only our expectation, but our actual right to privacy from government intrusion. The relationship between the doctor and his or her patient in our society is unique. A physician is privy to the most private details of a person's life, details that can be devastating to a person's personal, social, and professional life if revealed to third parties. And this law seeks to interfere in the relationship with the use of technology, your databasing, and a big brother approach, government monitoring and reporting. The existence of a government database may very well chill the relationship between a patient and his or her doctor, who might be afraid to work with their physician to seek necessary pain medication if the information will be shared and second-guessed by government officials. Moreover, such information can be misused by state officials in their dealings with the subjects of this information. This proposal seems to invite such misuse. On the one hand, the legislation suggests that law enforcement can only obtain information pursuant to a court order. And I must note here that it's been talked about that it's a very high standard to obtain that court order, and I respectfully disagree. It's a very low standard, and I would encourage, if there's any further discussions about this, that you also invite the criminal defense lawyers in to provide their perspective as you talk with law enforcement about this standard. But if one reviews the language supporting documentation submitted by the Board of Pharmacy in the 05 session, a large part of this program is intended to interface with law enforcement officials. And again, I'll note that even Senator Cruz said, well, the purpose of this is to go after those who are abusing. And the only way I would understand is that's getting law enforcement involved with folks who are breaking the law. But I quote from the material submitted earlier, one objective is to identify drug-seeking patients, rather individuals attempting illicit prescription scams, and practitioners who are seeking inappropriately prescribing for personal use or for non-medical use in order to get them connected with appropriate medical treatment, drug abuse treatment referral, and law enforcement follow-up. And it further states coordinating efforts with law enforcement personnel. And a quick review of the DEA material and program around this makes it clear that law enforcement is a key part of the legislation. And the plan for our government is to turn over to, potentially to turn over to law enforcement, private and personal medical information of Oregonians. Now, I want to talk about the protection of the information obtained by the government. In this day and age, the same technology that allows us to collect and database this type of sensitive information also makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to maintain confidentiality of this type of information. The financial costs associated with trying to do so, particularly with the way this proposal is riddled with backdoor opportunities to release and share personal medical information with other entities, can be very high. And yet this proposal makes no attempt to begin to even address this critical issue. Now, immediately prior to testifying on Monday, I reviewed the recent database disclosures that have happened most recently across the country, and I've attached to my testimony 17 pages of summaries of database breaches, in the vast majority of which are 2005 and 2006 alone. And I've also attached some articles of the most recent breaches. Now, I thought that the most recent breach that would come up on this search would be our own Oregon Department of Revenue, that it would be at top of the list, having only occurred last week. So you all know the Trojan virus that got into a computer of an employee that then resulted in taxpayer information being disclosed. But the fact that this doesn't, and this issue happened here in Oregon, should all make us stop in our tracks and consider the ramifications in Oregon when we're discussing this type of proposal. But imagine my surprise when I reviewed the internet listing of these things and found four additional breaches that have been reported since the Oregon Department of Revenue, from a stolen laptop with ING USA Financial Services to a computer hacking at Western Illinois University, a stolen computer at Union Pacific, to a stolen server at the American Insurance Group. This is all after the alarming aftermath of the data breach from the United States Department of Veteran Affairs, where as many as 26.5 million U.S. military veterans and current active military members had their very personal information stolen. The financial costs after such a breach are enormous. Just ask Providence Health System after the theft by computer disk and types of patient information here in Oregon. Are we prepared for that? Another summary provided by the Privacy Right Clearinghouse describes the types of breaches that can occur, and it's important for the committee and for us, the public, to understand that there are many different ways that private information can be breached. It includes bogus accounts established by ID thieves, lost backup tape, exposure through online activity, exposure by email, email erroneously sent, hacking, password compromised, stolen laptop, missing laptop, stolen computer, illegitimate access by former employee, and dishonest insider. If the federal government and the private sector, the latter of which has both resources and high incentive to protect its client data, cannot protect data, why do we think the State Board of Pharmacy, which estimates the full implementation, including hardware and software acquisition, upgrade maintenance, office supplies and postage, and agency personnel training, operation and outreach, will cost only between $150,000 and $175,000 per year? How can we imagine that we'll even begin to comprehend, let alone attempt to meaningfully address the security breach implications that this type of database creates? Despite this, Section 2 of the proposal, and for purposes of this, I am looking at Senate Bill 1093, Section 2 of the proposal gives unprecedented authority to the pharmacy board to decide what, if any, standards it wants to adopt for operation of the electronically controlled substance reporting database. Let's review the language. Quote, the State Board of Pharmacy shall establish and maintain a database for electronically reporting the dispensing of controlled substances, unquote. But it then goes on to state the board may adopt rules for the operation of the database, and it includes standards for electronic reporting, maintenance, security, and disclosure of the data, ensuring accuracy and completeness of the data and the persons or entities requesting information from the data. The pharmacy board is not required to set up any safeguards, let alone adequate safeguards. And as I stated earlier, this is becoming more and more difficult and certainly will cost a good deal of money to even begin to ensure the minimal level of security. I have raised this concern in the past, and with all due respect, because I'm saying that, and I think Mr. Schnabel misspoke unintentionally. He knows I've been concerned about this, but unfortunately, I actually didn't get the invitation to the coalition. I did hear about it and have indicated to him my interests and concerns about this issue. But as I say this, I just want to be clear where I've raised this, and I've raised it last session. And this proposal has been around for a few years, and there have been absolutely no steps taken to even begin to address this very serious issue. And are we really comfortable leaving it up to the state agency rulemaking to make those decisions? Now, I want to highlight some other very specific aspects of this proposal here for you today. Section 2 also gives unprecedented authority to the pharmacy board, the authority to add any drug it determines has a potential for abuse to this database list. That means without legislative oversight or authority, the board may add any and all drugs to the database for tracking by the state government and used by other state and federal entities. Now, I've attached to my testimony a list from the Oregon Administrative Rules, the schedule of controlled substances that will be included. And my quick review shows at least 100 right off the bat. But then if we're talking about including any and all drugs, it's endless. But the current number is very large indeed. You know, the end result of this and the authority under this proposal, the pharmacy board wants to play big brother with government snooping into our personal private medical decisions we make with our doctors, and this would be an unprecedented government invasion of some of our most personal medical information. Now, I'm sure many of you do not even discuss with family and friends what medicines you are on. After all, many of you consider our medical conditions quite private. Indeed, Senator Morissette, you mentioned earlier, the distinguished representative from Arizona, afraid to come forward. Do we really want government to collect and maintain this personal information? This proposal is silent on how consumers will be identified so as to avoid any confusion as to someone's identity. What system will be set up to assure accuracy? Is it simply going to be a person's name? But that type of identification is ripe for inaccuracy, particularly with common names. Section 3H allows collection of, quote, other relevant information as required by rules adopted by the board. Is this going to be your Social Security number? If not, what will it be? What will be the unique identifier? And how tempting will that information then be for someone who wants to steal it? The decision and the scope of information the board will collect on us is left entirely to the discretion of the board. What happens if you're wrongly entered into the database? How will you ever know, and what recourse do you have? This reminds me a bit of the continued debacle around the no-fly list that Senator Nelson has, for one, experienced firsthand. There's a Dave Nelson on the no-fly list. It's not the Oregon Senator, Dave Nelson. Nevertheless, once he got on this list, or rather list, it's been nearly impossible for him and other folks like him to get off the list. And here we're talking about receiving necessary, even life-sustaining medicine. Will pharmacists be barred from filling the prescription if your name pops up? Will law enforcement be called by the pharmacist? What will happen to the patient during this bureaucratic nightmare? And what if the board's database got it all wrong? What recourse is there for consumers? Under this proposal, absolutely none. Indeed, the board, which will be responsible for ensuring the safety and accuracy of this data, has under Section 3, Subsection 6, given itself immunity from civil liability if it violates whatever rules it establishes to ensure accuracy and security. So whatever happens, we as consumers, no matter the injury caused, will have no recourse. There is simply no incentive beyond the board's assurance of doing the right thing that this information will be carefully maintained. You've discussed a little bit already about this proposal does not require either notice be given to or consent from a patient at any time. This proposal allows the Board of Pharmacy to collect information about us from our doctor and then release information without our approval or even knowledge. And I was alarmed today when Mr. Schnabel indicated not only will it be released if a doctor calls about a specific patient, but doctors will be receiving unsolicited reports. And that raises a whole alarming area of concern about the safety and security of that information that will be released into medical providers' offices and communicated either electronically or through the mail. I won't go there. I'm raising the alarm bells on that as well. But this whole thing seems an unprecedented and wholly inconsistent in terms of no notice and consent with the approach we've been taken to ensure patient confidentiality and required consent regarding our medical records, both under state and federal laws. Third-party distribution. This proposal allows release to another state if the consumer or doctor live in another state. The pharmacy board, without our approval or knowledge, is going to release information to an outside state entity, which in turn has no obligation to keep this information about us confidential. Again, there's no attempt in this proposal to ensure that this information will not be subsequently shared with states or others that receive it. And regardless of what that information is, there are private companies out there that serve both the public and private sector, and the goal is their merging data on all of us. There are such flimsy protections under this proposal that it really is probably only a matter of time before this information starts leaking in and being merged with consumer profiles. Now, I want to just touch on and raise a concern about adjoining states doing this, and it's been reported that Oregon is a target for abuse because adjoining states have these protections and we do not. My understanding is that Washington State has not passed this law, and I believe my quick review showed that there was a bill introduced like this this past session. My understanding is that they only have a law right now regarding pharmacies keeping records, but not the database. So I would, and I think it's noted on the sheet you've got that Washington is a bit different, but I like us to at least understand that better. Now, the interface with law enforcement. Who alerts law enforcement to the potential activities to be investigated? It seems clear from the earlier testimony that one of the goals of the pharmacy board is to intervene with people it believes are misusing these medications, breaking the law. Well, how do they intend to intervene? Will staff of the board engage in that activity? Will they seek assistance from law enforcement to provide what they would describe as medical information intervention? Ms. Peller testified earlier that even right now she encountered a woman who was abusing through her father, and she abusing drugs, and she testified that she got law enforcement, the authorities involved in that case. So I raise with you the issue of not the pharmacy board necessarily calling law enforcement, but you are providing information to pharmacists and doctors who will have no bar in calling up law enforcement. So there is a back door, and it's pretty big, with how you can get this information to law enforcement to instigate a criminal investigation on someone. Now, last session, the committee correctly identified a few flaws concerning the issue of how these records will be used by law enforcement. And although the bill suggests there is limitation on the use of this data, that isn't correct. It simply says at the end of Section 3, Subsection 7, that reports from the database may not be used as evidence in any criminal or civil proceeding. But I can tell you what this doesn't mean. It doesn't preclude use of these reports to obtain other evidence that would be admissible in court. And it has no effect on federal laws or federal prosecution, including the DEA. In fact, this raises a whole separate concern about the potential use of this information by the DEA and the federal government, as you've heard, which still does oppose Oregon Death with Dignity. And there was a congressional hearing back in Congress about a few weeks ago on Death with Dignity again, as well as the use of medical marijuana laws. Further, nothing in this law can or will stop federal law enforcement officials from obtaining information from this database. HIPAA has exceptions to allow for release of medical information without a warrant. Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act allows the FBI director or his designee to get a court order under the Federal Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for production of, among other things, medical records. And there's also the ability of a special agent in charge of the FBI, that's the head of each FBI in every state, to obtain a national security letter without, actually it's a letter that they write themselves. It's not with any court review. And it gives them the ability to go get documents without going to court. So I want to raise a complete understanding of the protections that are in this proposal and the protections that are not. Finally, and there is a finally today. This proposal allows the board to receive grants or donations to assist in the cost of establishing and maintaining this database. To us, this raises a conflict of interest, as it's easy to predict that there will be high motivation by those in the business of databasing to offer grants or discounts to secure the business. The board will be motivated to go with a company that can provide services at the lowest cost or is willing to help absorb the cost but may not have adequate safeguards. This proposal does take us down an extremely dangerous road. And I have to say that when I have told consumers, Kathy Hahn testified, she said she hoped consumers and folks were had an opportunity to engage and discuss about this. When she got talked to doctors, you've got one perspective. When I talk to anyone about this, I am met with uniform alarm at the idea that this proposal could move forward. And indeed, the ACLU of Oregon is alarmed, and we urge you to seriously consider and move back from this proposal. And I'm happy to answer any questions now. Thank you for your attention. I really appreciate it today.
Okay, question. Yes, Senator Bartley.
I'm looking back at, thank you very much for your comments and the thoroughness of your testimony this morning, this afternoon. Mr. Chair, I'm looking back at a program narrative summary accompanying the description of Senate Bill 1093, and this appears to be a summary that was prepared by the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. It's
this date document. February 24th, 2005.
Doesn't have a date on it.
Oh.
Yeah, it's January 10th, 04, the date on this document. Okay. And there is a problem definition written here, and I'd like to talk about this problem definition. It says the diversion of legitimate prescription drugs for personal abuse and for distribution to the illegitimate street drug market remains a serious problem in the state of Oregon, as it is across the country. Accurate statistics remain unavailable for Oregon because the state of Oregon has no organized program to gather such information. Anecdotal evidence exists, which documents that a significant prescription drug diversion program has persisted for years in Oregon. Similar drug diversion problems in other states have been well documented by state and federal agencies. What I would ask us to focus on is the statement that accurate statistics remain unavailable for Oregon because the state of Oregon has no organized program to gather such information. What's missing in this hearing And as we are discussing whether to move forward or how to move forward, what's missing is that documentation that that tells us clearly what the scope of the problem is in the state of Oregon beyond the anecdotal information. And even the anecdotal information is missing in terms of something that's concrete in the form of a report that says this is what the anecdotal picture looks like in the state of Oregon. So in the absence of data collection and any testimony that tells us that there is a plan to put in place data collection, we haven't heard that testimony from the Oregon State Police or anyone else from law enforcement saying that someone's looking at that. We have a problem. We know that there's a problem that persists, but again, public policy should be based on sound information, evidence that there is a problem that needs to be corrected.
Okay.
There is a problem, but how big is the problem?
I think that's
where's the evidence? Point.
Did you respond?
Yeah. Chair Morrissey, Senator Gourley, I agree that when we're dealing with issues and concerns and problems in our society, it is best to do it and to address solutions with a better and full understanding of the problem. The concern we have is, as I've hopefully more than thoroughly articulated to you, of the creation of a database that contains very personal and private medical information, that's at grave risk. And to collect simply the data to know we have a problem, and we certainly know we have limited resources in our budget probably to even adequately address those who need drug diversion programs today. Might we be better equipped if we had that data? Certainly, but the government, where do we draw the line at the government acting as our big brother and collecting data on all of us under the guise of being able to better address problems? Statistics and basic information is one thing when it's not tied to a person. You're sometimes asked to give information, and it's assured that it's anonymous, it's not tied to you. But what we're talking about is going beyond simply collecting data that might be anonymous, which might be useful. It is connected to a person, and there will be consequences for them.
Follow-up.
Yes.
As we do the research looking at what other states have accomplished in those states where the law has been enacted or there's something pending, I would like to know more about what information those states used as a basis for enacting their laws. Did they use data? Were they data driven? Were they driven by anecdotal, emotional, you know, whatever? Let's try to pin this down as much as we can.
Now, would it help also to have some documentation of the attitude of physicians? I mean, you know, again, there's some anecdotal mm-hmm. information about doctors in general really like this. Well, how many doctors really like this, and why do they really like it? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if there is some information that has been gathered. Maybe there is, but if there isn't, there should be. Because I'm kind of curious, because last year I heard of the chilling effect it had on doctors who were afraid that they would be, you know, Big Brother was over, you know, looking over their shoulder, and they would be held accountable if they prescribed the wrong kind of drugs. And on the other hand, physicians are rightly concerned, I guess, of the drug shopping. But then you raise a good question: if a physician can get that information and wants to prevent anybody else from getting it, you know, I, as a doctor, you can call and say, "I want to know about so and so," and then suddenly, you know, that's no longer confidential information. Law enforcement. You know, the doctor can call law enforcement, say, get a warrant. Maybe that, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's, I'm trying to figure out if it's the end justifying the means, and maybe, you know, the end and the means, maybe the end is a good end that we're going toward. There is, I think there is a problem in our society, and this is, I think we have an opportunity to address that, but I appreciate the work that you've done, because I think you have, you know, pointed some things out that we need to look at seriously as we move along.
Chair Morrissey, yeah. I appreciate that. I mean, I do hope you will look at the fact that, I wonder how doctors will feel about the fact that all drugs can be added to this by the State Pharmacy Board, that there are no protections for, because it's also a tracking of physicians as well, is concern about their abuse.
There's already a note here to change the may to shall as a suggestion.
In terms of safeguards? Or in terms of
rules of operation, electronic control systems, and so on.
Senator Morrissey, that's one issue, which is that they shall, but again, we're leaving it to them with a budget, no budget. They've not asked for an allocation of a whole lot of resources in this, so I appreciate the shall. It's a pretty easy one. There's also the fact that the board, not the legislature, may add any drugs it deems necessary that are being abused. You're sitting here. We've debated this issue for a number of sessions simply on certain controlled substances of a discrete area that doctors are coming forward and saying we're being pushed because we're not, we're being looked over by government and we're being pressured. And you've had hard enough time moving forward and the legislative body, but you're going to be giving the authority to the state agency to add any drug, which could be any drug.
Okay. The legislature is an oversight body. I mean, we write legislation. We have administrative rules to administer it, and then we watch it. I don't know that we can micromanage, you know. That's a hard one. I think that we have to work, you know, put the safeguards in, and then we have to do the oversight.
Chair Morissette, I mean, at a minimum, and I have to confess, I think it's pretty clear there's basically nothing I like about this proposal, but you certainly are establishing specific controlled substances in Section 1 of this proposal. It is limited currently to only Schedule 2, 3, and 4 drugs. You are then in another section abdicating the authority to decide if you want other drugs on there. If, at a minimum, they should have to come back and explain to this body why any additional drugs should be added. Not let's get in with this very discrete problem that we can get folks to articulate a basis for pain management and then open the door at the state agency level with rulemaking and no oversight generally by the public to add any and all drugs.
Okay.
You do have a choice as to how narrow you frame this at the front end.
Okay. We're talking categories of drugs, not just are we talking individual drugs?
Chair Morrissey, under the bill, Section 2, Sub 1E, states that the State Board of Pharmacy shall may add drugs that have the potential for abuse other than controlled substances to the reporting requirements of this law as deemed necessary by the board.
Okay. Again, I think we'll talk about the safeguards, but again, I think that there's an oversight issue here, and I'm not sure that we can cover every eventuality in legislature. We need to review it. We need to have oversight of the board and the advisory council, and I don't know how else, you know.
Chair Morrissey, with all due respect, I suggest you not give them the authority to expand the list beyond the ones that have been specifically given to you today. If you're even going to this proposal, they are articulating a particular problem that's going on with certain controlled substances in terms of pain management. Does that cross over to your diabetes medicine, your heart medication, any other pharmacological, that's the correct term, any other drug? You're making a policy decision about with certain reasons behind this proposal as to why you're going forward. I would urge you to say, that is all the authority you have. If there are other problems in other drug areas, you'll need to come back to the legislature for additional authority to add that to your databasing.
We will consider that. Thank you.
All right, Senator Morrissey.
Yes.
I think one of the things that Andrea has brought up that I think is of concern to a lot of us and is the kind of information that is readily available today on many aspects of your life, not just medicine. Albertsons knows what kind of cereal you buy. So I think that there's a tremendous amount of information out on every person. And I think that it certainly concerns me. I think that if people are drug shopping, then if you are not drug shopping and you have legitimate reasons, you probably don't care. Yeah, you probably wouldn't care a bit that you knew. If I'm taking pain medication and it's a legitimate pain medication, I probably don't care if you can find that information. On the other hand, we can't save people from themselves either. So consequently, when you get this information and you find out who's drug shopping, how much can we do really to save that person from themselves? Now, the Corvallis Clinic, you heard that testimony, which I think is good. But on the other hand, I think that there's a lot of things. So I think this is multifaceted, and I believe that I have to agree with Andrea about the limiting of medications. In other words, I don't think it should be open-ended. I think there should be medications that are typically abused, but I think to have it open-ended where you can add all of those is becoming quite broad. And I think that her point is well taken on that.
Chair Morissette, yeah. Senator Verger, I appreciate it. And I know, though, that while some people feel that they have no problem if their medical information is disclosed because they might have nothing to hide, I know we already heard from Senator Morissette that there are others that do, but I would raise for you the specter of what if it's inaccurate information? What if it's not you? Also, what if it's not you and you're not then able to get the medicine you need? Because the database is messed up. Yeah. What is the board planning to do that? What, I'd hope you ask them, do they plan to use as the unique identifier for all of us? And what do we have as recourse when there's no, they are entirely immune from liability, but regardless of the immunity, what recourse do I have when I go to my pharmacist with a prescription and they run a check and they say, Andrea Meyer, you've got this drug. And I say, no, I don't, and I need this today. You do. If you've got a question, here's a 1-800 number you can call Monday through Friday. Try to work it out. I have to get myself off the database or corrected in the database. So, it's not always just I have nothing to hide concerns. Government and sometimes gets it wrong, and that when it gets it wrong, it can hurt us as much as it can help us.
Okay. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've made a difference.
I appreciate that. I do. And I am happy to continue.
With me, you have.
Yeah, but you always change your mind by the last person.
From one who opposed this bill in its totality last time, I am seriously, I support it, but I think I want some safeguards. And I think, the Pain Commission has presented their safeguards, and I think there are compelling reasons to do it, but I think that there needs to be some safeguards included. And for no other reason than that somebody will be the victim of a mistake, and that's a good point.
Right.
Because, once that's made, then you have to live with that until you can correct it if there's no way of correcting it, so that's got to be worth doing.
I'll tell you what else I think is unfortunate about our discussion today, and that is that the ACLU, I understand that an invitation was extended or there's some mix-up, but that you haven't been in the room as a part of that coalition or partnership that's been trying to hash this all out. And that's respecting your position and everything that you've said. And there's still an opportunity to get in a room and have some conversation. But it is unfortunate that didn't happen.
And Chair Morris, right. Senator Gorley, I'll remind you of history. There was not only last session where I did testify, and I have to say I took a lot of what I said here today from the testimony I gave on the record in writing last session, but there was also Senate Bill 630 in 2003. And how did I get involved in that? Good Senator John Minnis sent out the alarm on a bill that was, as my recollection, this one is worse, in our opinion. So our concerns have been out there, and you'll see my testimony is attached to the end. Mm-hmm. I have tried to lay out and identify all the concerns, but I've not done it in entirely in ways that I've further identified some questions you all have today. What are the unique identifiers? How will law enforcement be there are ways to get around this. What protections are there? Or is the intention to have doctors and pharmacists and others calling law enforcement when they see a problem? If that's one of the intentions, I would certainly like us to be up front about how law enforcement can get involved in a lot of different ways other than just a court order. So I appreciate it, and yes, I'm happy to go to any meeting and certainly give our input, even if we will vehemently oppose the bill if we can make it less worse.
So would you be satisfied if we put ACLU shall participate in all meetings in the statute? Would that be for that?
The full, I'd love to see that, and I'd love to see you get that passed on the floor. And you,
Senator Cruz will take care of
Senator Cruz can carry that. With
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I get a clarification, is there a general consensus of the committee that we move forward with the concept? I think we need to, with the understanding that there's going to be amendments,
yeah,
adjustments, but conceptually we are willing to take a hard look at it at our September meeting.
I'm willing to look at additional information, the information that has been requested through this hearing. Mm-hmm. But with that said, the testimony from Ms. Meyer and the ACLU gives me pause.
Okay.
This is not information that I've heard in this context before, but having heard it, again, it certainly gives me pause.
Well, I would say that from my perspective, and in all due respect, the ACLU is wrong on a lot of things, in my opinion, including a lot of what she talked about, and I do believe the passage of this bill would not end civilization as we know it, and you know, but that, which is kind of the scenario you paint here, and I guess from the perspective of law enforcement, if your desire is to protect drug shoppers from going to jail, I can't support that. So you know, I agree. Let's see what other states have done, what their data is, how it's working for them. But on first blush, well, second blush, third blush on this issue, I think this is a tool that will help doctors. It'll help people that it'll help the pain patients, I think, because there'll be clear records of this stuff. It's going to, you know, one of the things we, since clear back on the Pain and Symptom Management Task Force, we were looking at was how do we get doctors to move towards this new culture, number one, and how are they protected in doing that? And this is a tool that helps out. You know, the drug shoppers is one thing, and that's all well and fine. But I think that, from my perspective, is a minor part of this. This is going to help us with good medicine and giving people what they need. I think that's the major portion of this bill.
I have a question for staff. And in statute, is the Board of Pharmacy considered a law enforcement agency?
No. Chair, if the question is for me, I'm seeing nods from the back as a no, and I would I would say no. They're a regulatory entity.
Regulatory. No. That's the word I'm
They're
looking for.
Regulatory.
Okay.
Chair Morris, Senator Gordley, and I would be happy to participate in the meetings. I hope someone like you, if not you, will also be there to kind of help get some of the answers to the questions I've been raising for a few years, really find out the details in this. And I had a hard time getting some of the clarifications to these questions, so I need a little help.
Okay. I don't see this as protecting drug shoppers. I you know, I think that's one of the reasons to do this is to prevent that from happening because drugs end up in the street and so on. But I also see it as I'm concerned about the privacy issue. And it's a wide open system because if any physician can get all the information they need on a, well, okay, there's a lot of information that can be had by the physicians that can be passed on to law enforcement and so on, which is not all bad. There needs to be more work done. Senator Bridger.
I think that we need to really have a little bit clearer idea of what we really want to achieve here. In other words, we're confusing a few things with, I know Senator Cruz has brought out, there are other things other than just finding the drug shopper. And I really believe that people that are shopping around for drugs, in my mind, have a serious, serious problem. They could be a member of anybody's family. They need help, and they need to be stopped, and doctors need to be able to stop them. And so they need that vehicle in which to do that. I'm very concerned, and I don't always agree with Andrea. She knows that. But in this case, I am very concerned with the amount of information about people that is out there and the ability of government to get it wrong and to get someone mixed up is not beyond anything. I think, however, there are maybe some other states that we are not inventing the wheel. They probably have had this same identical discussion, and perhaps they've come up with some things like identifiers that would help protect that they would absolutely know that it's me without social security number. It can be a password. It can be a lot of things that can be used. So I'm interested in the information that we will be getting that would help us on the privacy issue.
Senator Stark.
Yes, I like this Senate bill. I won't be back here next session to vote on it, but I very much would like to see this move forward. I think it gives us a wonderful tool to help doctors and pharmacists, and safeguards are important. But I agree with Senator Cruz. I very rarely agree with anything ACLU brings forward.
Sometimes.
And that's perhaps tragic, but I see them as very detrimental to our society as a whole, and cannot encourage them in any way.
Okay. I guess we will plan to develop language, and we will come back in September, and we will see if we have something that we want to submit as a draft, that with the idea that as we continue to get language. So I'm assuming that we will end up with something, Gary.
Yeah.
But I think we're all concerned about some of the details, and I think that we can solve a lot of these without losing, you know, the essence of the bill, which is to protect, just to make sure that people are not drug shopping, and but at the same time protect the individuals, and particularly those who are caught up in the system inadvertently. That's the other big thing. So with that, we'll be back in I see you're 1 o'clock people are here. What time should we be back? 45 minutes. How about that?
1:30.
We will be back at 1:30.
Okay. So, yeah. The